Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Nevertheless, they could not understand that I'm a black man and I can never be a veteran.
Two of the last four living members of the B-1 U.S. Navy Band were serenaded at the corner of Franklin and Robertson Streets, where the historical marker now stands. Calvin Morrow is 93 years old. Between 1942 and 44, he and the other men marched in plate down Franklin Street to the UNC campus, where white cadets assembled for the raising of the colors.
Being black, being always put down, we had been treated as human beings. That's something to think about.
The 44 trained musicians were the first black men allowed to enlist at general rank in the U.S. Navy. Leonita Inge, North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC.
Tennessee. Dance St. Louis's 10th Annual Spring to Dance Festival takes the stage this weekend at the Two Hill Performing Arts Center. The festival features more than 30 dance companies from across the country, and St. Louis On the Air contributor Steve Potter takes a closer look at one of them.
Dance styles of all kinds will be on stage as part of this year's festival, and it's a different program each night. Collage Dance Collective is one of the companies featured this year. Kevin Thomas is the artistic director and joins us now from Memphis, Tennessee, where the company is based. Kevin, welcome to St. Louis on the Air.
Thank you very much, Steve. This is wonderful. We are so excited to be able to perform in this prestigious festival. So we are looking forward to this.
Now, the festival features all kinds of dance companies doing all different kinds of dance. Now, you're a ballet company, yes. Correct?
We are a contemporary ballet company.
Yeah, how do you describe your company to people that aren't familiar with it?
Well, we are classically trained, so the girls are in pointe shoes, and all the movements you can see come from the classical ballet aesthetic, but we bend it a bit, so that's why it's contemporary. And that kind of choreography, I feel, also helps bring in people, audiences, new audiences to dance. Mm-hmm. Who are not, you know, really familiar with ballet. This is how we get them in here in Memphis, is through our contemporary programs. And then they're ready for something classical.
You say it's contemporary, so where does your repertory come from? Is it from you?
I am one of the choreographers, but this piece has been choreographed by Darrell Grand Moultrie, who is a Princess Grace winner and a alumni of Juilliard. And so he's actually choreographed three works for us. I've choreographed probably over a good dozen works for the company since we've been in existence. In our rep, we also have classical pieces by Sir Frederick Ashton, like Two Pigeons and Thais. And we also do a Nutcracker, so that's definitely very classical. And then we have, you know, we go to the very contemporary side, where we're working with Joshua Mankiewicz, who was featured in the St. Louis Spring to Dance show last year, and he's very contemporary modern. Mm-hmm. So, yes, we do a large genre of works to get all appetite for our audience.
One of the things that stands out to me about Collage Dance Collective is the fact that through dance, you address a serious social issue, and we'll get into that in just a little bit. But first, can you give me a little background on the company? I know it was originally founded in New York. I guess it was more than a decade ago. What can you tell us about that?
So I was a principal dancer with Dance Studios Harlem when we began thinking about putting Collage Dance Collective together. And then back in 2005, I believe that's when Dance Studios Harlem closed its doors. That's when I decided that I really needed to put more effort in making my company become more visible. So that was the beginning of Collage. And then, you know, years later, we realized that there are 1,000 companies in New York. And if we really wanted to do what we want to do, basically, we needed to be somewhere else. And we found Memphis. And Memphis has, the population is about 75% African American, and our mission is to inspire the growth of ballet. And we, you know, realized if we really want to be true to our mission, then being in Memphis would really make sense, because I really wanted to spread the word of ballet to African American communities, making ballet more accessible. And that's what we've been doing here in Memphis.
That's probably, Kevin, I'm thinking, not as easy as it sounds, making ballet accessible to people who aren't familiar with it. What kind of challenge has that been?
Oh, my goodness. Every challenge possible. From the culture of ballet, you know, as far as the looks, the hair, the tights and all that, and then how many rehearsals and ballet classes you have to have per week. You know, they weren't quite ready for that, but they love it. The kids here love it. Mm-hmm. When I first began, I was told that, you know, I would never get any boys into ballet, and we have the largest ballet program here in Memphis. So it's really just showing. Once people see, once the audience sees that people who look like them are on stage doing this, then it becomes accessible immediately.
And I mentioned this earlier, Kevin, that maybe it's more common than I think, but I was so interested how your dance company is sort of involved in social issues, African-American culture, and in particular the issue of discrimination. Isn't that fairly unique for a dance company to have that kind of perspective?
Yes, it is fairly unique, but I think it's necessary for us and what the climate is of today, you know, to talk about what we are going through. It is necessary, and the reason Collage is what it is definitely comes from my own experiences, too, as a dancer, because when I first started dancing, you know, I was the only one of color. So I definitely went through lots of situations where there was lots of discrimination against me because of the color of my skin. Definitely there were roles, ballet roles, I could not do because they couldn't think of having a black prince when I was young. So definitely now, as an artistic director, you know, I want to change all that. I want to make sure that that is no longer an issue.
I'm sure you don't think it's perfect now, but you must have seen things change a lot since you were that little kid.
Oh, absolutely. I have seen things change. They have changed quite a bit, but there is still a lot more to change. Because not only are there issues with dancers of color getting jobs, but also ballet teachers who are of color are not being hired or not considered ballet teachers because we are the wrong color. So that's another issue that has to be addressed, absolutely.
One thing I think also is really unique about Collage Dance Collective is the role that photography plays in what you do. And I know there was one particular photograph that went viral earlier this year, but talk about how photography figures into what you do.
Well, what makes it... How can I say it makes it, I mean, you know, a picture, you know, is like 1,000 words, right? Mm-hmm. So getting the right image and putting it out to our social media, really, we're able to capture what Collage is about, send it out to our audience, and have them appreciate what we're putting out there. So definitely that picture that went viral, you know, I remember that photo shoot, we're thinking about playing on the colors of our tones, the dark tones, the light tones, and then just featuring our ballerinas, our five ballerinas, who are all very beautiful, And they all possess that classical line. They're all different hues. And that just really resonated with social media. And you could see it before your eyes that people started liking it, that it just went crazy. And that was wonderful.
Can you describe that photograph?
Yes. It is of our five ballerinas. And basically, you're seeing different hues. We have a ballerina who's more chocolate, one who's more caramel, one who's a little bit more vanilla. But they're all standing in susu. Susu is it's called fifth position. Their legs are tight together across. They're in point shoes. And they are showcasing the lines that are necessary for a classical dancer, for a ballerina. Lines that they say that dancers of color do not possess.
Mm-hmm.
Several days ago, I received a message from both of our lawyers, Bob Boyle and Brett Grody, informing me that the latest lab test came in from discovery requests. And they told me that the hepatitis C infection level is at zero. And as of today, I'm hep C free. This is in part due to some fine lawyering by Brett and Bob, who, remember, filed the suit while I was in the throes of a diabetic coma, unconscious, and thus unable to file for myself. But it's also due to you, the people, brothers and sisters who supported our efforts, who contributed to this fight with money, time, protests, and cramming courtrooms on our behalf, who sent cards, who prayed, who loved deeply. I can't thank you all individually, but if you hear my voice or read my words, know that I am thinking of you, all of you. And I'm thanking you for showing, once again, the power of the people. This battle ain't over, for the state's cruelest gift is my recent diagnosis of cirrhosis of the liver. With your love, we shall prevail again. I thank you all. Our noble doctors, Corey Weinstein, who told us what to look for, and Joseph Harris, who gave me my first diagnosis and who became the star of the courtroom by making the mysteries of Hep C understandable to all. An internist working up in Harlem, Dr. Harris found few thrills better than telling his many Hep C patients that they're cured. This struggle ain't just for me, y'all. Because of your efforts, thousands of Pennsylvania prisoners now have hope of healing from the ravages of hepatitis C. Let us march on till victory is won. So goes the old Negro spiritual, the Black National Anthem. We are making it a reality. I love you all. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. Doesn't mean we're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But, you know, when I talk to Malia and Sasha, and I listen to their friends and I see them interact, they're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues. And that's true in every community that I've visited all across the country.
Parents in the Birmingham School District raising concerns about what they call blatant racism targeted at their kids.
They say they are fed up, and tonight they want some answers. 7 Action News reporter Gino Vici sat down with those parents and students who are demanding the district take action. Gino?
Well, that's right, Stephen, Caroline. Ironically, the character word of the month here at Berkshire Middle School in Birmingham is trustworthy. One parent I spoke with tonight says she doesn't trust the school is hearing her concern. That's why she says she reached out to 7 Action News to get some answers.
It hurts a lot that we have to come here to this. It hurts.
Maia Nelson says she's emotionally drained from hearing about all the racist remarks directed at her young daughter and other African-American students in the Birmingham School District.
They're saying the N-word directly to me, or I hear them in the hallway saying it.
Nigga!
They said that one boy told me that black people are dumb directly to me. Again, People are posting on online, the KKK with the bag over their head.
12-year-old Morgan Howe says she's been dealing with blatant racism here at Berkshire Elementary for the past year. She says it's gotten so bad there was a time she wishes she wasn't black.
Yeah, I didn't like my skin, didn't like my hair, didn't like anything about myself. Wanted to be white.
Most recently, this picture of a white student on Snapchat with a bag over his head and KKK written on it went viral with parents and students at Berkshire Middle School. Morgan says she thought the boy in the picture was her friend.
I saw the photo and they were laughing about it, thinking it was funny. Wasn't really funny at all.
Kennedy Banks, now 13 years old, says she's also been dealing with racist remarks. And says it's been tearing her apart emotionally.
No child or parent should ever have to hear their should ever have to go through this.
Kennedy says when she confronts other students about making racist comments, she says they play it off like it's some kind of joke.
When has it ever been a joke? When has my race and my ethnicity ever been a joke? Like, you've never been through the things that we have been through. You don't have to be afraid.
Meanwhile, Morgan's mother says she wants answers from the school's principal, something she says the school has yet to address.
I want something to be done. I want someone to be expelled. I want an example made.
Now, the Birmingham School District has responded just moments ago. Their statement in part reads, quote, "The principal and central administrators were not aware of the events until this afternoon, and we have begun an immediate investigation. We were very saddened to hear about this incident and want to be clear that this type of behavior, if confirmed through our investigation, is not acceptable." There is surely more to come on this, and if true, such a heartbreaking story for these students. We're live in Birmingham. Gino Vici, 7 Action News.
Canada. We should move to Canada.
Have you heard? The Toronto Police Services Board might actually do something useful. I know. Shocking. I went to the meeting this week for the Toronto Police Services Board, and I was pretty shocked when action broke out spontaneously in the chamber because one of the 7 board members, Ken Jeffers, moved a motion on an item that was being discussed. And that item was, should Toronto schools have armed, uniformed police officers in them? This whole conversation about where police officers belong in our society is really, really blowing up in Toronto, and I think it's about time. I am particularly poised to say this because 7 years ago, I first started out writing news stories for Torontoist, which is an online publication, for those of you who don't know. Very proud to start my career at Torontoist. Did some very important work there early on in my career. I'm always grateful to Torontoist. Long may it live. The very first piece that I ever wrote that got published in Torontoist was about the idea of police officers being introduced into our schools. It was an idea that made me really scared and continues to bother me. And now we've had this program for about 8 years, coming on 9 in the Toronto District School Board and the Toronto Catholic District School Board. But the program was up for review recently. There's never really been a serious and independent review of this program of police officers in schools. But the police tell us anecdotally, surprise, surprise, that it's working really well. And it's helping to build relationships in community between young people and the cops. Now, why did we ever get police in our schools? And why don't all schools have them? Well, in 2007, an incident happened which, as far as I know, was unprecedented in a Toronto high school. A young man by the name of Jordan Manners, who was only 15 years old, was shot in the chest inside of his school at C.W. Jeffries. And Jordan Manners died from his injuries. Obviously, this incident struck great fear and concern among many parents and students and educators and others across of the city and across the province. And so a very large report called the Falconer Report, which was led by lawyer Julian Falconer, a really well-known criminal defense lawyer here in Canada. That report looked into how to improve school safety and how to make sure that an incident like what happened to Jordan Manners, may he rest in peace, that would never happen again. Now, there were 120-some-odd recommendations from the Faulkner Report, but there was no recommendation for armed police officers in schools. In fact, many of the people who were asked to contribute to this report said that doing something like that would only make the problem worse. Why would they say that? Well, it's very simple. Cops were not being introduced into our schools, according to the police and according to the school board that let this happen. They weren't being put there to go and patrol the hallways to stop somebody from getting shot again. Instead, the idea was that maybe part of the reason that this was happening, that violence was happening in schools, was because police didn't have good enough relationships with young people. Now, I don't really see the connection there, but that's what the school boards said, and that's what the police said. And so we got armed police officers in our schools. Well, 10 years almost later, because Jordan Manners being shot was in 2007, we're revisiting this issue again. And now there seems to be a desire on many of the board members, current board members of the Toronto Police Services Board, to say enough of this. We don't need cops in our schools. There are a lot of really good reasons for them to say this. One of them is that we have a sanctuary city agreement here in Toronto. And what sanctuary city means is that people who are undocumented in the city of Toronto have the right to access services just as anyone else does. And that includes the right to go to school. We have a legal requirement on top of that in Ontario that if you're beneath a certain age and you're not being homeschooled, you have to attend public school or private school or some kind of accredited school. So here we have police officers, some of whom are being placed in our schools. And what are they doing? They're trying to find out the immigration status of kids at school. And in some cases, they're calling Canadian Border Service Agency on children who are trying to get an education. That is a violation of the sanctuary city policy and of the police's don't ask, don't tell policy, which was supposed to prevent this from happening so that kids would not be scared to go to school, that maybe someone would ask them about their status. But the police have been violating that. We heard at the police services board that the police have been targeting students just like they target them on the streets, and that they have disproportionately been targeting black students, indigenous students. This is no surprise to anybody who knows how the police behave, but this is what's been happening. And so for whatever good people might say is coming out of this program, the most vulnerable kids, the ones that the police and the school board said that they wanted to make better relationships with, those are the ones who are being discouraged and frightened by this program. It is absolutely time for it to end, and I'm glad that this is going to be coming to a vote next month. But we see again here, just like with Pride, the focus and what we have to stay focused on here. I'm going to remind you again, no one said that these armed police officers were being brought into our schools to patrol the schools. In fact, the police took great pain to explain that that would be inappropriate, that you don't build relationships with kids by patrolling them with a gun. And I agree with that. But that's what's been happening in the schools. So what the police told us they were going to do, they've been doing the opposite. And that's why this program needs to end. And we need to get support workers back into our schools, guidance counselors, hall monitors, people who can work with kids with special needs, people who are trained to work with children need to be in our schools and not somebody who has a gun. Those people are not trained as police to work specifically with kids, and they're being thrown into these situations as if they are the experts. It's not appropriate. And with all of the lack of resources we have in our schools, think of the better choices that we could be making. Now, Patrick has called in, and I think Patrick feels like I'm being unfair to the police. But go ahead, Patrick.
You know what, Desmond? I don't think that you're being unfair at all. In fact, I agree with much of what you're saying in terms of, you know, finding appropriate staff members for schools, because the schools are sorely understaffed. The staff are sorely undertrained to deal with the growing population of kids that have, less than typical needs. Some have special needs, whatever. But the only thing I take objection to is this underlying contempt that oozes from what you're saying for the police.
My contempt is for how the police behave.
Listen, it's not how the police behave. It's how people behave. There are people that behave poorly that are police, and there are people that behave poorly that aren't police. The problem is that the people who are police officers who behave poorly do so with impunity, and
correct.
That needs to stop.
Well, okay, but Patrick.
But what I'm saying is you're perpetuating a culture of us and them if you say police.
I am not doing that, and I'm going to explain to you why. Police have a tremendous amount of power, and I know you and I agree on that. So when police know that their colleagues are finding out the immigration status of kids at school and reporting them, when they know that they're going up to kids in the hallway who are just having a conversation and trying to break it up as if they're the authority figure in that school, that's not why they were put there. Wouldn't you, as a colleague of that police officer, check them and say that's wrong? Wouldn't you stop them from doing things that were hurting kids? But police officers don't tell on one another. So you can tell me about all of the good ones, but they watch this happen every day and they don't do anything about it.
I do understand what you're saying, but there's also a growing culture of entitlement, and it's scary to see how absolutely ignorant and belligerent young people can be today in confrontation of everybody around them. And I don't care if it's a police officer, a school board member, or another parent. It takes a village. None of these kids, every one of these kids, you know, today you see online confronting somebody or slipping somebody the bird.
Now who's making stereotypes, Patrick? Come on.
I'm not making stereotypes. I'm not talking about all kids. I'm talking about confrontational kids who don't understand how good they have it here in this country.
What does that have to do with the police using their power to call immigration on kids without status?
Okay,
what does that have to do with it?
It doesn't have to do with that.
Thank you very much.
Why is it about that?
That's because...
Why is it every time a police officer speaks to somebody that it's inappropriate?
Well, they have rules.
You made an example.
They signed an agreement saying they wouldn't do that. Yeah, they signed an agreement saying that they wouldn't report kids to immigration, and that's what they're doing. So whose problem is that?
Then that might be an issue on its own. But
it's a huge issue.
Removing them from having a presence in our community is a way to deal with that.
Well, I'm sorry. I'm going to have to disagree with you here and wrap up because we're out of time. When the police do right by us, they'll be welcome everywhere. Until they do right by us, we're going to get them out of our communities.
Seattle's a great place to visit because it has, I guess you could say, a little bit of everything, but I like to think of it as a lot of everything.
If you're a person of color in this country, every day you might encounter oppression that remains from systems set in motion hundreds of years ago. The inequity that results affects everything from jobs to education to housing to healthcare. So given our history, what would it take to really bring progress toward racial equity? Kianga Yamada Taylor is an author and professor at Princeton University. Her research examines race and public policy. She told KUOW race and equity reporter Patricia Murphy that America is making progress, but it's mixed.
I think for the general public that there has been some movement in terms of a greater understanding of the challenges presented by racism for ordinary African Americans. I think that that is one of the lasting impacts of the Black Lives Matter movement. But I do think that in terms of the persistence of police violence, the persistence of underemployment and unemployment, the persistence of under-resourced institutions that Black people disproportionately rely on, that there continue to be disparities in that sense. And so I think that there's a mixed picture. And I think given some of the rhetoric of the incoming Trump administration, we should expect that picture to remain mixed, if not become even more cloudy going forward.
What would racial equity look like in the United States?
That's a difficult question because it assumes that the United States is an equal society, except on the question of race. And so we saw in 2011 the emergence of the Occupy movement. Well, what that movement was all about was a sort of base core inequality that exists in the United States, what activists then described as the 1% versus the 99%. I guess what I'm saying is that we can talk about racial inequality, and we should talk about racial inequality, but we also have to talk about and deal with the fact that there are 20 million poor white people in this country. And so if the goal is simply to integrate into a society that also impoverishes white people and leaves people in general in questioning how they are able to survive on a day-to-day basis, then that's not very much of an accomplishment.
Here in Washington State, King County has put a lot of money behind an office that's dedicated to achieving racial equity. How valuable are efforts like this?
I mean, I think all of those efforts are important, and I wouldn't decry any of them. I think usually what happens in situations like that is the funding and appropriations for offices like that is, you know, often the victim of attrition, or there are never enough resources to really make sure that the promises of an office like that are fulfilled. Often what elected officials say then is that we should get rid of those offices for being ineffective, when really the solution is to create more resources and to create more kinds of efforts like that. Because if you think about it, we have all sorts of laws on the books that ban discriminatory behavior in employment and education and housing. To me, offices like that that are dealing with the issues of racial inequality are things that should be encouraged, not discouraged.
Have you seen cities or institutions do a good job in working towards equity?
No. I think that the best examples that we have are situations that occur in the aftermath of political struggle. And so, you know, if we take an example like Black Lives Matter and the way in which protest in 2014 forced even the office of the presidency to dedicate resources towards responding to this issue of police violence and abuse in African-American communities. Now, that effort has been incomplete and unsatisfactory. But I think that there is a model that we can see sort of over history and throughout time, that the way that we move, you know, race relations, for lack of a better word or term, ahead is not through endless commissions, endless discussions about things that we already know. It happens when people are organized and get on the streets and protest and apply pressure to our existing institutions. I think where people have been able to apply pressure, that's where we've seen the greatest movement and change.
Are you hopeful that we will seize this opportunity as a country and make progress?
I am hopeful, and that's a strange thing to be, it seems, right now. I certainly was bewildered the night of the election and for many weeks after. And I'm hopeful, but I'm also, you know, concerned. I think that Donald Trump is a bad person. I think that he and the Republicans are out for blood. I think that they see that they have a small window in which to reset everything. And I think they want to smash and grab as much as they can. But there is a long history and tradition in this country of resistance, of fighting back. We have to reconnect that history with people who are in struggle today as a way to build confidence and to connect ourselves to a struggle that is greater than what is around us today. And I believe that we can do that. When you asked me earlier, are people ready? I think people are tired. I think people are angry. And I think that people want something different.
Kianga Yamada Taylor is an associate professor at Princeton University. She's the author of the book, From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation. She spoke with KUOW's Patricia Murphy.
KUOW is looking into how racial inequity shapes the Seattle region. You can get involved in the conversation on our Facebook page, KUOW Public Radio.
Oh, my God.
What?
I can't believe it.
He's cute.
We, like, totally needed a black kid.
What?
This town, it's, like, so white.
Well, a question for you. What happens when teenagers from two very different neighborhoods in Washington, D.C. get together to talk about where they're from and race? It's part of a project run by a teacher who hopes it will help bridge D.C.'s expanding racial and economic divide. Michaela LaFrac from Here and Now contributor WAMU was there when students from one predominantly black school and one majority white school sat down to get to know one another.
120 teenagers pack into the gym at the Murray School, a majority white private school in Northwest Washington, D.C. They sit in clusters, waving at kids they know and eyeballing the ones they don't. Murray teacher Io Magwood stands in front and welcomes the visiting students. They're from Cesar Chavez Public Charter School in Southeast D.C., where 83% of students are black and the rest are Hispanic. This event is Magwood's brainchild. It's part of a year-long program she thought up during the contentious presidential campaign.
I was very concerned whether young people would be able to grow up and be able to talk across difference and understand each other.
Washington, D.C.'s schools show evidence of the city's racial and economic disparities. A study from the University of California in Los Angeles this year found that over 70% of black students in D.C. public and charter schools have virtually zero white classmates. Cesar Chavez has no white students. Earlier this year, students in the exchange program went on a joint field trip to the National Portrait Gallery. Magwood remembers how one Cesar Chavez student reacted.
An African-American student said, "I just want to say something. I have never spoken to a white boy before, but you are cool. You guys are cool." And so they really enjoyed meeting each other, but I was just struck by the fact that many of these young people have zero contact with each other.
At this event, the students start by breaking into small groups to introduce themselves. The tone is pleasant, but a little awkward, as you'd expect from any group of teenagers who don't know each other that well.
My name is Imani.
My name is Brianna Washington.
My name is Callan.
I'm Owen.
Then they get into the big stuff. One group gathers around a picnic table on Murray's sprawling front lawn and dives into an hour-long conversation on race and privilege. Murray 10th grader Journey Hairston and Cesar Chavez 11th grader Angel Anderson talk about how the city feels segregated.
Differences are okay, but, like, since we make people, like, benefit from the differences and, like, we put people in bad places because they're different than others, that's when it becomes a bad thing.
I just believe there's no such thing as race. I believe it's just a label.
Murray sophomore Callan Daniel and Cesar Chavez junior Angel Johnson discuss the differences between some of the city's neighborhoods.
Just, like, getting out of your own neighborhood can sort of show you, at least even if you don't speak to anybody, it can show you the differences.
Because I know a lot of people from Southeast that are, like, really nice, and they don't do, like, a lot of bad things, and not everybody is like that, and not everybody up here is, like, bougie because, like, their guys are nice. You just got to, like, see and try to, like, experience it because you never know, like, who you're going to meet. Like, everybody has a different story.
The conversation is a little stilted at times, especially when they talk about privilege. But there's one thing they all agree on. Donald Trump.
No one likes him. Anyone that doesn't say it.
No Republicans in my school. I don't even know any Republicans. The day I meet a Republican, I'm going to give that person a hug.
Like the Republicans that have said that they're Republicans at Murray, they're like, they make sure to draw this distinction that they don't support him.
As the conversation wraps up, Cesar Chavez history teacher Elizabeth Genesco says she doesn't want to draw any grand conclusions about the program's success just yet.
It's difficult to tell right now. I know that, like, the actual test of how this went is years down the line, months down the line.
Murray's Io Magwood agrees. She says she knows this one program isn't going to solve the city's vast racial segregation, but hopefully it's a start.
You just have to chip away at it and hope that other people are chipping away at it too, and hope you're moving at least in the right direction.
Soon, it's time to say goodbye. The Murray students go back into their building, and the Cesar Chavez students load into two big white buses to head back across the city to their own school. For Here and Now, I'm Michaela LaFrac.
All we need is a voluntary, free-spirited, open-ended program of procreative racial deconstruction.
Everybody just got to keep fucking everybody till they're all the same color.
More and more people are getting married to individuals from a different race. In fact, Pew Research just conducted a study where they took data from the census and found that one in six newlywed spouses are of a different race or ethnicity. Okay. Now, to give you some more information on this, Pew Research also found that overall, one in 10 people, or 11 million, one in six people who married in 2015 wed someone of a different race or ethnicity, the highest proportion in American history. However, if you look at the overall number, one in 10 people, or 11 million in the United States, have spouses of a different race or ethnicity. So if you're younger, you probably think, well, yeah, what's the big deal? I mean, I've seen mixed couples all the time. It's pretty common. Well, if you just rewind 50 years, the number was much lower. Only 3% of people in the country were, it's called intermarried, which sounds very strange. Yeah. Intermarried sounds like you're marrying like a different species or something.
Right,
but, yeah.
Right. No, I'm outer married. Okay, anyway, I'm actually one of the intermarried.
So am I.
That's right.
Yeah.
So what's more amazing is that interracial marriage was illegal in this country in many parts, not in every part, but in a lot of states until 1967.
I know, it's crazy.
Only in 1967 did the Supreme Court say that, no, it's unconstitutional to bar different races from getting married to one another. What's even crazier, in 2012, there was a poll done during the Republican primaries in Alabama, Mississippi. About a quarter of the Republican voters still think interracial marriage should be illegal.
That's so insane.
It blows my mind, because they live in a different world. They have different facts, they have a different reality, and in their world, like, getting married to a black person, a white black person, or any racist mixing is so outrageous, they think it should be banned. Whereas in LA, no one would blink an eye, no one would care ever, and if someone believed the things that they believe, we'd look at them like they were monsters.
I just feel like, look, Skittles is right. You should taste the rainbow.
Wow! Hey, yo, drama, hold up, sir. Hold up. Stop the motherfucking record. All right. I want you to Pondy replay, drama. Pondy replay. Let's give him one more chance, man. Run that shit the fuck back.
Look, Skittles is right. You should taste the rainbow. Right?
Well, that's got a couple of connotations.
Anyway. I mean, it depends on what you're into, but I feel like staying within your race and going even further and staying within your nationality is so incredibly boring. Like, for me, and by the way, if that's what you want, if that's what you desire, do you, no judgment. But I don't want to live in a society that forces me to be with someone who's exactly like me. I get a lot of pleasure out of learning about other countries and other cultures. And it's, a relationship is the best when it's a learning experience, when you learn from the partner that you have,
Yeah.
And I feel like, yes, if it's someone who comes from the exact same culture as me, there are certain things that, we understand about one another. And there's a certain level of comfort there as well. But get out of your comfort zone, just appreciate different cultures and understand that just because someone's a different race or a different nationality doesn't mean that, it's the worst thing in the world and you're mixing. And I feel like people who have this activated fear center in their brains are the ones that get turned off by the idea of intermarriage.
Yeah, and so let me explain also the old world and the new world. And there's a slightly different take on this too, which is that, so in the old world, the reason why they told you to marry within your own clan was because you were going to fight the Canaanites and you needed as many babies as possible who were Israelites or Philistines or whatever, right?
Yeah.
And so they're like, oh my God, marrying the Canaanites is the worst. You're going to give them babies. You're going to give the enemy babies and they're going to kill us with them. Are you nuts?
You got to marry the Philistines and have babies with them.
Okay, so that is where this whole tribalism comes from. That's why. And that has come all the way up to now, where people still, from the old world, like Turks think, oh, you gotta marry a Turk. I know you got the same pressures as Armenians, and then still some of that, a lot of that is left in America, where people think, no, you gotta marry within your race. But in the new world, we're actually are marrying within our cultures. It's just that our culture is no longer based on race or ethnicity.
That's right.
In a place like LA, now a lot of the country, most of the country, I would argue, our culture is an American one that's, you know, made from TV and online. And look, media is the culture, right? Mm-hmm. And in the old days, your culture was all politics was local, all media was local. So you married somebody from your hometown because that's all you knew.
Yeah.
Right? Now, all that media and culture is national and in some ways global. So we're all part of that big culture. Now, there are pockets of culture, of subcultures that have not changed. And hence the Alabama and Mississippi Republican voters who are like stuck in a time warp. And they're still like, oh, no, no, my culture is, I don't like the other race, I like my race, right? So, okay, but yeah. Most of us have moved on from that. And finally, we're winning. We're going to win, they're going to lose.
Yeah, because we're mixing, right? And I think that's a great thing. So whenever we talk about how we need to move past race in the country and, you know, what the possible solutions are. Look, you can get the government to reform certain things. You can tackle things like institutional racism, institutionalized racism. But nothing is going to work quite as well as the fact that we're all going to have sex with each other. We're all going to procreate and we're all going to have mixed babies, right? And then, like, the idea of race is going to be kind of ridiculous.
Yeah, we're almost getting there for the younger generation. So finally, last optimistic note here. Like Anna said, 50 years ago, it was only 3% that was interracial marriage. Now it's 10%. But among the people getting married today, it's 17%. Now, which way do you think that's going to continue to go? It's not going to go backwards. It's going to go forwards. Mm-hmm. We're going to make more progress and we're going to have more interracial marriage. By the way, if you happen to marry someone within your own race, there's nothing wrong with that at all, right? Just find the person you love. I know, radical thought. Mm-hmm. For conservatives, they're like, whoa, that's a weird thing to say. No, no, no. I mean, as long as they're within your race, right? But those guys are all ancient, man. They're going to be doing this to the end of time.
I thought I asked for an African-American to replace Terry.
You requested an Afro-American?
African-American. Jerry, you know I did. I put it in writing.
I didn't see it. You see it?
If you don't like her, you send her back.
Yeah, you tell her you didn't like her performance because she was white.
What? That's not the point.
Flipper, she's been here for 5 minutes. Give her a chance. This sounds dangerously like reverse discrimination to me.
Well, there's been an ongoing row in the papers and on social media about a new Netflix series called Dear White People. It's based on an earlier comedy film which satirized the experience of black students at a predominantly white Ivy League college. Now, the trailer, which showed white students blacking out for a fancy dress party, has been particularly controversial. It was accused by many on Twitter as being racist to white people, which raised our next big question. Can white people be the victims of racism? Well, many people will say, of course they can, but there are some interesting arguments as to why they cannot. We are about to explore them. Esther, it's great to see you back on the program from the Pan-African Reparations Coalition. Now, I don't know if you saw Three Girls, that
yes,
really
I did,
powerful
yes.
drama. Saida Varsi, who's a stalwart campaigner against Islamophobia, but she said that the Pakistani men in those grooming gangs saw these white girls as third-class citizens. Is that racism?
No, it's not. I think the key thing here is that that situation was very complex. There were racial dimensions, but the basis of the oppression of those young girls was based on their vulnerability in terms of their sex and gender, and in particular their social class. So if we're linking that to racism, what it does, it denies the fact of what racism really is. Racism is a global system mm-hmm. of oppression and exploitation that is meted out to peoples who historically who have not been racialized as white. So that is what racism is, and it's not particularly helpful to just focus on individual cases. What happened in Rotherham was abhorrent. It was awful, it was terrible, and it was abuse.
But
it was not based on race.
Aren't individual cases about us as human beings and what happens to us in our daily experiences without looking at overall sort of global structures of power? Look, scientists say that pigmentation is it's a color spectrum, right? There are no definite boundaries. So some will ask, where on the spectrum do you stop being a potential victim of racism?
Well, in terms of not being a victim of racism, it's those who at any time can actually benefit from that global system. So if we just reduce it to what's happening in, a so-called white working class population here in Britain, and we don't look at the fact of if somebody from that community moves, that their whole status and their sense of power and privilege actually will also change. So that's what we need to focus on, really. And so we're talking about a system of racial inequality, what's called white supremacy, that is about defending this system of power, race and privilege, and in particular wealth. So that actually determines how we relate as individuals. So the interpersonal aspects or individualized aspects of racism, you cannot divorce it from these global systems of who gets divided as being black and who is classified as white.
Could black people be racist towards Polish people?
No.
Right. Because, Betty, look, we're going to...
No, but, I mean,
we're going to juggle a lot of stuff around here.
Racism and racial discrimination are two different things, and it's about who has the power to define, and white people have redefined racism.
I understand
what's
your arguments.
Happening to Polish people is based on their national identity,
I understand
not
you.
Their race.
I understand your arguments. Betty King of Betty King Ministries, do you think that white people can be victims of racism?
Yes. Everybody can. White people have been and are still victims of racism. It's revenge. Black people were discriminated against. Pakistani people were discriminated against. Whenever people meet, it's almost like they need to revenge on what was done to them. And I think in this time, in this season that we are in, all over the world, people are calling for equality. When the opportunity arises, yes, white people can be discriminated against. I do believe that.
Mm. What about Irish people, Les?
Well, first, I find that that statement...
You want to respond to that first? Yeah,
I think it's pretty peculiar because you're conflating and confusing discriminatory practices based on the way people are presented in the world with some other systemic discriminatory practices. First and foremost, racism is prejudice plus power. That's what racism
That's
is.
That's right. Yeah.
And it works in the sense that if you're black, let's say black or of African ancestry like I am, you know that the system is set against you. Mm-hmm. Now, if you ask me whether the Irish could be racially discriminated against, I teach that. And if the viewers want to look, they can look at how the Irish became white by a group called Race Traitor. Because what happened was, let's say, for instance, it's called How the Irish Became White. Because, for instance, when I was growing up, I was born in the UK. When I was growing up, the Irish, if you put them in another framework, they were a lesser race, a bit like Germans with the master race against the Jews. So I would teach the Holocaust as a racist incident because of the context. The context is you've got a white group oppressing another white group and publicly stating they are an inferior race. So if you want to understand how that works, Schindler escaped Nazi Germany by pretending to be a Jew. So it can only work in that context. If the oppressors were white people and the oppressed are black, and that black person freed some of those white people, could he have escaped with them? Or could she have escaped with them? So I think we should be very careful about when we talk about racism versus discriminatory practices, because as Esther said, this is a systemic thing. So, for instance, if you've got a white person who believes they are racially discriminated against, let's say it's because they're Polish, they've got an accent, if they keep their mouth shut and move in different arenas, they will not be discriminated against. They have to actually speak. We don't. It's the skin we're in that legislates against.
It's a huge argument as to whether Islamophobia is racism or not, or discrimination. That's a huge, huge debate. But just supposing that you are on the side that it is a form of racism, is a Pakistani attitude to Christians, where they are really awfully discriminated against, and is that racism?
Well, it's not racism.
Are Christian Pakistanis suffering from racism in Pakistan? If indeed criticism of those who adhere to a belief system is racism, surely they're comparable.
What you would, for me, it's comparable if you look at it on the level of discriminatory practices and how people feel as human beings for being discriminated against. However, the framework is religion. That's what that's about. Just like what's happening in Nigeria,
it's
there are impositions.
People. It's othering people.
So othering is the crucial point, because in all of these debates and discussions, that's sociology 101. So is it gender? Is it race? This is an inherently racist, classist and sexist society. Anybody who doesn't really appreciate that isn't going to understand how it's set up and structured systemically. So, of course, you could look at people, let's say, for instance, in Nigeria, where you've got Christians and Muslims killing each other every day. But that cannot be racist. That's premised on religion.
Mm-hmm. What? This is interesting, isn't it?
So, right, people usually get stunned when I start.
Wait a minute, Simon.
But here's the
people
point,
at home, come to the point in a minute. Sure. I want to hear what the audience does. Some people at home will be saying, well, racism is racism. I've had racism against me. Well, you've explained your point. Anyway, gentleman there in the white shirt.
Does that mean you can't be racist against Jews in Britain, for example? I mean, clearly, as a white man, if a black person's racist to me, and in 50 years, I have to say, in South London, they never have been, and I'm thank God for that. But if they are, I take that can't be taken nearly as seriously as if a white person's racist to a black person who's in a minority. But Jews in Britain, for all sorts of reasons, disproportionately are millionaires as a proportion of the population in the UK. I think that is true. Does that make them holders of powers? I mean, I can't be...
No, I think...
I'm just a little bit uncomfortable with that. Let's get audience, more audience. Right at the back, gentleman there with a beard.
I think the question in itself is racism. The reason being, when you start dividing people on colours... someone is white or black, when you start dividing people on a religious basis, when you start dividing people on their background, that's racism in itself. So the question being that whether white people can become victim of racism is racism in itself, because human beings are equal and everyone should be treated equally, whether they're white or black.
We need to get beyond race.
Yes.
Esther, just a final thought from you. How much of this is about class?
I mean, there is an interrelationship. However, class is also racialized, because no matter how much people of African heritage, for instance, or Asian heritage may elevate themselves in a particular system, they can still be redefined and reduced to a subject class.
Absolutely.
That's the point.
Absolutely.
So we cannot use class to, get rid of racism. Racism is a global system. The reason why it exists is because not enough people who benefit from it are actually doing enough to counter it. And we must also recognise there are different forms of racism that affect different groups, and it's linked to this historical system that is actually also bolstered by state power. So we cannot exclude the role of the state in actually enforcing
Absolutely.
That power.
Absolutely.
Seven feet. Barren, strange fruit. Blood on the leaves, and blood at the roots, black bodies swinging in the southern breeze.
Yesterday, someone left a noose inside the new National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C. It was discovered by tourists who were visiting the museum. And on the same day, the N-word was found spray-painted on the gate outside LeBron James's house here in Los Angeles. Here's what he said at a news conference yesterday.
No matter how much money you have, no matter how famous you are, no matter how many people admire you, you know, being black in America is tough. And we got a long way to go, you know, for us as a society and for us as African Americans until we feel equal. in America.
The incidents at the museum and at LeBron James's house are still being investigated. But according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, there have been more than 1,800 incidents of what they call hate and bias since the election in November. Earlier today, we called up Carol Anderson to talk about all this. She's the chair of the African American Studies Department at Emory University and the author of White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. And I asked her if she ever wonders, how are these things still happening in 2017?
I know. You want to believe that we have really gotten better. As a historian, what I know and what I detailed in White Rage is that as we move forward to a more inclusive, robust democracy, that the entrenched forces of reaction fight back hard.
A columnist in the Washington Post has suggested that, you know, when the investigation into yesterday's incident at the Smithsonian is over, that the police should actually give the noose back to the museum to put it on display and to mark it and say, noose, symbol of contemporary hatred and racism, 2017. Mm. What do you think about that?
Yes, because one of the things that we like to do is we like to think of racism as something in the past. It is something from which we have overcome. I mean, this is why you get this kind of elegy about the civil rights movement. We love that triumphal democratic narrative, but we haven't overcome. It's just that the chameleon of racism has changed shape, and it's scrawling the N-word across LeBron James's gate. It's hanging a noose in the National Museum of African American History and Culture. It's drawing, as they did in North Carolina, congressional district boundaries in order to dilute the voting strength of African Americans. I mean, we see it in all of these various different forms, but we only recognize it as something in the past.
What do you think is the most constructive way to kind of move on from this and to try to get better?
We have to, A, really know our history and not the myths that we have been told, so that we don't get drawn into the kinds of elegies of we have overcome and then can't understand why we're seeing what we're seeing. We have to be more engaged in this democracy. And that means demanding greater accountability of ourselves and of politicians. We have to be more humane and more empathetic. That's how we begin to break this thing.
Carol Anderson, author of White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
I watched a white riot in Portland, Oregon on television the other night. News said they did $1 million worth of damage. Every black person was watching that like amateurs.
The Portland, Oregon man accused of killing two men after they stood up to him as he shouted anti-Muslim hate speech will be arraigned today. He stabbed the men as they came to the defense of two young women, one of them evidently Muslim, wearing a hijab. A third man, who also tried to protect the women, was injured. This all took place on a light rail train. Reporter Amelia Templeton is covering the arraignment and joins us to talk about the case. What charges is the state planning to file against the suspect, Jeremy Christian, today?
Two counts of aggravated murder, one count of attempted murder, felon in possession of a weapon, and then also intimidation. And that is Oregon's version of essentially a bias crime charge for somebody who threatens to harm someone on the basis of their race or religion. And we've been told that there could be additional charges in the coming days. The FBI special agent here says it's too early to determine yet if domestic terrorism or some kind of a federal hate crime charge might be applicable.
What do we know about the suspect in this case, about Christian?
Well, all of this stems from an incident Friday when the suspect boarded a MAX train and then, according to witnesses, began to direct a biased rant against two teenage girls, one of whom was wearing a hijab, and then proceeded to stab the men who tried to intervene. Christian had a criminal record. He had been convicted previously for robbing a convenience store and a kidnapping charge and had served time for that. And in recent weeks and months, he had showed up at a protest in town and given the Nazi salute, said a number of bigoted things, and had also reportedly thrown a bottle at an African-American woman at another public transit stop earlier that week.
And what can you tell us about the victims in this crime?
There were three victims. Rick Best was an Army veteran. He'd served for 23 years and then retired from the Army and had gone to work for the city of Portland. He has four surviving children. Talishan Namakai Meche was 23 years old, a recent college graduate, and reportedly his last words, according to one witness, were, "Tell everybody on this train that I love them." A third victim survived the attack and has left the hospital, but according to his friends, is facing a long recovery from his injuries.
Now, white nationalist groups are planning two upcoming rallies in Portland, and Portland's mayor has appealed to the organizers to cancel those events. What's he worried about?
I think first just that these rallies not further traumatize Portland's Muslim community. This attack happened at the beginning of Ramadan. People are already feeling vulnerable. But additionally, Portland over the last several months has been the scene of a lot of increasingly tense confrontations between protesters protesting the Donald Trump's presidential administration, Portland police, and counter-protesters, sort of alt-right groups. And I think the mayor is concerned that given what we have seen over the past several months and given the tension surrounding this event, that something could really blow up and that we could see further violence.
Amelia Templeton is a reporter with Oregon Public Broadcasting. Thanks.
You're welcome.
We now turn to the chair of the Oregon Coalition Against Hate Crime, Randy Blazak. He teaches criminology at the University of Oregon and has been tracking the white supremacist movement in the state for more than 20 years. Welcome.
Hello.
While Portland has a reputation for being progressive, it is also the whitest big city in America. Tell us about Oregon's history with racist policies.
Well, we've kind of got a long history that goes back to the founding of the state. I mean, the Oregon Trail was the Land Donation Act was for white settlers only. The state was founded in 1859 as a white-only state, and that was on the books until 1922. Portland and Oregon had the largest Klan west of the Rockies, the largest per capita, actually, in the whole country.
That's amazing. So, Oregon had the largest per capita Klan membership in the entire country?
That's right. It was very active. They elected a governor, Governor Pierce, who went to work outlawing Catholic churches as one of his first duties, which was soon overturned by the Supreme Court. But it was a very active Klan state, and it's a part of the explanation about why Portland is as white as it is in the year 2017, as this long racial history the state has.
Has Oregon ever taken steps to address or undo legacies of its racist past?
Sure. I mean, it's had to rewrite some parts of the Constitution that had words like colored people and mulattoes in the Constitution that was only taken out about a decade ago. There's been an attempt to redress or at least acknowledge some of its history, but it's kind of woven into it up into the modern day issues around gentrification, where we see minority people being pushed out of neighborhoods to make room for incoming moneyed whites. I mean, it's sort of this long story that's been told that has many chapters, and this unfortunately is just the latest chapter in our history.
Well, what do you see in today's chapter that's different from what we've seen in the past?
You know, we've certainly had racial violence, including the murder of an Ethiopian immigrant by skinheads in 1988 in Portland. But this version
I remember that. I was in school at the time in Portland.
Yes, Mulugeta Sarraw. I mean, many people still remember that incident. That, you know, this brings about the role of the internet, the role of online radicalization, and the way that this subculture has sort of morphed into this more invisible world. I mean, there used to be physical places that you would go to Klan rallies or to skinhead meetings, and now it kind of takes place online and people express those views more openly. And so it's a new version of an old phenomenon, but in a way it's more insidious because it sort of exists in the ether and not in a physical place.
We just heard about the debate in the city over whether this so-called Trump free speech rally with alt-right groups should be allowed to go forward. Are you concerned that there could be more violence if these happen?
There's a lot of tension that's been building. It's been building in the city for a long time. I mean, Portland became known as Skinhead City in the 1990s because of the rival factions of racist skinheads and anti-racist skinheads going at it. And so we're seeing a new version of this, but it's been kind of magnified by the election politics and the rhetoric of the alt-right and the ability to kind of rally the troops fairly quickly over the internet. And I think the city is sort of bracing itself for something that might turn quite ugly.
Do you go into the chat rooms and other places where these communities gather online? And can you describe how they've been reacting to this stabbing?
You know, both sides have been talking about this incident. There are members of people on the right-wing side of the spectrum that would like to see more of this violence and have vilified the victims as sort of the people who prop up the status quo and defend multiculturalism and the Islamification of America, as they've called it. The people on the left side are concerned that the police are overly protective of what they're calling fascists in the streets of Portland and are not doing enough to shut down these folks, who of course have a First Amendment right, but also are causing concern around the issue of agitating more right-wing violence. So it's really, it depends on where you're standing, what the perspective on the city's role on this issue is.
That's Randy Blazak, chair of the Oregon Coalition Against Hate Crime. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Here is James.
There it is.
There
it is, right there.
Just passed Michael Jordan for number one all time. Most points in the playoffs. LeBron doing it in 212 games. Michael in 179. 5,989 points now for LeBron in his playoff career.
Sitting here on the eve of, on the eve of one of the greatest sporting events that we have in sports. You know, race and what's going on comes again. And on my behalf and my family's behalf. But I mean, I look at it as this. I mean, if this is to shed a light and continue to keep the conversation going on my behalf, then I'm okay with it. And my family is safe. At the end of the day, they're safe, and that's the most important. But it just goes to show that that racism will always be a part of the world, a part of America. And, you know, hate, you know, in America, especially for African Americans, is living every day. And even though that, you know, that it's concealed most of the time, you know, people hide their faces and will say things about you when they see that smile on your face. It's alive every single day. And I think back to Emmett Till's mom, actually. It's kind of one of the first things I thought of. And the reason that she had an open casket is because she wanted to show the world what her son went through as far as a hate crime and, you know, being black in America. So it's like it doesn't, no matter how much money you have, no matter how famous you are, no matter how many people admire you, you know, being black in America is tough, and we got a long way to go, you know, for us as a society and for us as African Americans until we feel equal in America, and you know, but my family is safe and. That's what's important.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, June 3rd, 2017. So I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have observations, questions, counter-racist suggestions, comments on any of the news clips we just heard. The number 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Before we get to some of the folks who have a hand up, I would, number one, this is listener-supported counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. You can visit the blog, the address racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you are not into PayPal, drop us an email. We will get you a physical mailing address. Huge thanks to all the folks who have supported us 8+ years. Hopefully, the broadcast, The Cows, has been worthy of your time and energy. Thanks for the folks who have supported the Amazon wish list as well at Amazon.com under Gus T. Renegade, also linked at the blog. A few things I wanted to point out, and then we will get to callers. That segment, the Princeton professor canceling her visit up here to Seattle, Washington, right at the beginning on KUOW in Seattle, they said people of color are accustomed to encountering abuse, oppression on a daily basis that is based on systems set in motion years ago. That right there, I don't know if it was a white person or a non-white person who was speaking. If it's a white person, I suspect that person is deliberately practicing white supremacy. They, mind you, context, they were talking about a non-white person who could not come to the great state of Washington because of threats, racist terrorism, and fear that they would be mistreated. They had to cancel a visit. That's not systems set in motion years ago. That's living, breathing individuals classified as white right now. That is consistently, that is predictably the way that racism, white supremacy is discussed, where we are not saying, no, this is not systems. This is not things that happened years ago and vestiges of race. No. This is Jane and Susan and Timothy Wise and Donald Sterling and Jane Elliott and William Willimon, all of the individuals classified as white. It is these folks that are doing things to abuse and terrorize non-white people, black people especially. That's what we mean when we say white supremacy racism. But I thought that was critical. The nonsense at the Young Turks. Are you serious? That right? I'm going to come back to that later. We'll just hold that. I'll come back to Young Turks. The portion, the big questions from the BBC, where they did the segment on can white people be victims of racism, have to acknowledge, hat tip, if you will, to Lorraine. She's been on the program repeatedly on the Global Sunday Talk on Racism. She's even participated in workplace racism. She's one of our listeners in the UK. And she told me at the beginning of the, and she called me no less. She called me. She had worked a really long shift and it was really, really like late. And she called me and she said, watch the BBC's The Big Question. They did this segment on can white people be victims of racism? You got to check it out. And she said, some of your guests, people that have been on The Cows, were on this segment. She said, Esther Stanford Cosey, she was the first speaker in that segment who said, no, white people cannot be victims of white racism. There's a system of white supremacy. She said that explicitly. And Dr. William Les Henry, also in the segment. But she told me that they did a really good job, so she told me to check it out. I found it, but it was on BBC's iPlayer, and I could not configure my browser. They used to have a way that I could change my IP address and get it to work, but they have whites do not allow that anymore. So I was trying to figure out other ways that I could access it. In the meantime, I asked if any of our UK listeners, if they might be able to download it and get it to me. And Mr. Fox responded immediately, and he just found it on YouTube, which I guess I was too incompetent to do. But I got it from YouTube. It was about, it's about a 20-minute segment if you want to watch the whole thing. But it's fascinating, particularly because it is orchestrated, using that word deliberately, by a white man suspected racist. But that, yeah, it's fascinating. And I was so proud to watch that segment because Dr. William Les Henry and Esther Stanford Cossey, both black people in the UK, who both in that segment brilliantly illustrated why white people cannot be victims of racism. Dr. William Les Henry used the example of Nazi Germany. Both of them, they haven't just been guests on the cows. They've been guests on the cows repeatedly, like multiple times. We had Dr. William Les Henry on the program right in the middle of the quote unquote London riots in 2011. And Miss Esther Stanford Cossey, she's been on the program repeatedly. And in fact, she even gave us some great recommendations. Dr. Shafia Monroe, the founder of the International Center for Traditional Childbearing. It's a long title, but great, great information. She has since stepped down as president, but she did found that organization. We had her on the program all because of the great Esther Stanford Cossey, but it was a great segment, and I felt so pleased that they gave such great information and that we've had them on the program. I'm going to see if we can get them to come back and visit with us again soon. The segment about the incident in Portland, they had Randy Blazak. You can add his name to the list when we talk about it's not systems, it's individuals classified as white, like Randy Blazak. He also has been a guest on this program. He was with us last year. He admitted to being a racist white supremacist on this program, and that was one of the first things that I brought up. They had him on an Al Jazeera segment last year to talk about white supremacy. I think it might have been in relation to something that happened in the Pacific Northwest, but I could be in error about that. Anyway, so they have him on, and he does the normal, you know, I'm an understanding, informed white man. I'm one of the good ones, and oh yeah, I'll tell you, racism, oh yeah, it exists, and oh yeah, it's been here for a long time. I am not going to say that I personally am racist, but, you know, oh yeah, I'll say a lot of things and acknowledge that you do have a lot of mistreatment going on because of racism. We got him on the program within the first 10 minutes. Oh yeah, admitted racist white supremacist, and then we go from there. And he even tries to make a big to-do about me, you know, starting with that immediately, which many whites, many racists do. They don't want to be identified as racist. They don't want you to have appropriate, correct suspicion of them where you understand you have an enemy. But yeah, he goes on and gives his spiel. There is important information about the history of white supremacy in Portland, because a lot of people don't think of this portion of the world or a lot of victims don't think of this portion of the world as being steeped in white supremacy like everywhere else. But, you know, as state that all the time, very important to learn as much as you can about, you know, everything, as much as you can about many, many things, particularly if you happen to live in that part of the world. Know your local history. But yeah, the most critical piece of information, he himself, racist white supremacist. As I get to my reminder about no metaphors, which I state every week, compensatory call in, no metaphors, please. Frequently, racists, they use metaphors to practice deception. They will equate things, they'll use analogies, similes, make comparisons between two things that are not equivalent. That tacky Anna Kasparian in the segment where she says, oh yeah, I'm in a quote unquote interracial married. I'm intermarried. That's even a new term. I hadn't even heard that before. People can, you know, share if they've heard that term used. But she says, it's like Skittles. The tackiness of it. And I'm even thinking of Trayvon Martin in all of that. But the tackiness of it all on top of this, oh yeah, interracial marriage is, you know, increasing. So yeah, that means we can equate that with a decline in racism, white supremacy, which is absurd, absolutely absurd, has been forever. And I'll state again, anytime that a white person does that, when they use these comparisons, analogies, metaphors, these are acts of racism. This is done deliberately to be deceptive. You can even think of that as multiple metaphors being incorporated for this purpose, equating increased quote-unquote intermarrying with an inter-racism and the Skittles metaphor on top of that. But this happens all the time. Victims of racism, we have heard a lot of Anna-Kasparians through the years. We've been exposed to a lot of racists and their behavior. Also, we are still learning, Gus T. Renegade especially. And so sometimes we're still trying to formulate our thoughts, ideas. We incorporate a metaphor or an analogy and hope that that accurately conveys our thoughts. Often it does not. It just adds a lot of confusion, and a lot of times things are being compared that are not similar. If we could just be direct, explicit about what it is we want to say, no metaphors. I will prompt about that. Thank you kindly. Folks, could take about 5 minutes to share whatever it is you would like to say. I will ask if you could, if you know you're in a noisy environment, if you know people are talking around you or if there's music or whatever it is, if you can use your mute button, just help to preserve the quality of the broadcast. Then once you're done, once you spoke or what have you, can mute yourself again. That would be helpful. Whenever you want to speak, you can unmute again, just to help to preserve the quality of the program. With that, folks who dialed in who have a hand up, I'll give out the number one more time, 641-715-3640, code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, everybody. 2812 from VA. A couple of quick things. Great content this evening. First thing is in reference to the LeBron James clip, the one thing that I find very interesting is when he's talking, I was just observing him. VGQ, I like the fact that he did mention Emmett Till, because there are a lot of young people who may not know about that. And it's always good when another victim mentions an act of terrorism by racist white supremacists. But I would just like a reporter just to ask him a question of who would be the likely person to spray this word on your gate? And it would be fantastic. And he said, oh, it would probably be a white person. That would just have racists just going crazy. But I just think that that would be a just be interesting. A lot of words. I believe Kyle Anderson was on the show, if that's who they were speaking about, if that's who they were talking to in reference to white rage, Gus, correct me if I'm wrong. BGQ, she used a lot of words. I thought that the interviewer was asking her a lot of questions that were making things a little bit unclear and were causing a little bit more confusion because she really didn't say racism, white supremacist. I even wrote down, she did and says, refinement of entrenched forces of reaction, fight back hard. And I didn't know what that meant, but that just means, AKA, white people are not going to have any of this. And sometimes I know that they wouldn't even allow them to speak if they were going to speak accurately about racism. So that's VGQ as well. It's on my brain because I listened to it yesterday driving home. But and I'm not sure if you mentioned it, but the Bill Maher clip. I'm not sure if you already had it on there, but him using the term house nigger. I believe it might have been a couple days ago or even last night. Reading some of the comments online from victims, and then immediately the first thing that is coming to mind are people saying, well, he gave money to Black Lives Matter. Even Michael Eric Dyson, another victim, saying he's done this and he's done that. And also the biggest thing is that, oh, he dates white women, so he should get a pass. And it immediately reminded me of the episode, which I think is probably one of the most important ones you've ever done, with Jessica Pettit, who basically said that she should be applauded for the work that she's doing. Mr. Fuller in Codification talks about we shouldn't want any applause and we shouldn't be getting accolades And basically, what these people, what these racists want is to be applauded for not practicing racism, which is the stupidest thing that I've ever heard. Don't practice racism if you're a regular human being, and the world will be a better place. But that's what they're doing. That's what we as victims do. We want to applaud Bill Maher and people like Jessica Pettit and all these other suspected racists want to be acknowledged and want cookies and awards for doing something that they shouldn't be doing in the first place. Or maybe they should, because racism is just in their blood. So great clips, and that's all I got. Thanks, guys.
Appreciate that as well. I did see the clip that was from last night with Bill Maher and his tacky commentary. Add that when I watched that this morning. It comes on late in the evening, so I watched it this morning. Other folks that we have not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, line should be open. My favorite, when people call their hands up and then they either, I guess, take a while to formulate their thoughts, or maybe they're not in a area where they can speak. But I'll get some of the other people that dialed in with a hand up.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
How you doing? Good evening, Jess. Good evening, callers. This is The Voice calling out at 305 Miami. I wanted to talk about the clip that was in regards to the lack of melanoid ballerina teachers and instructors. And it just brought me back to the whole story of Misty Copeland and Brooklyn Mack, who, you know, basically set history in ballet. And if you look at the whole history of the dance, and, you know, the choreography, when you look at the Janet Jackson, the Michael Jackson, majority of their choreographers are African-American, like Rhapsody James, who does a lot of choreography for TLC, Beyonce. You have Kendall Harris. She has done a lot. You even have an old-school ballet of Judith Jameson, who has done a lot of work for over, like, 30, 40 years. And it just goes to show you, it's just like basketball with the football, you know, where we all they want is the melanoid players. They want you to be active in the sport, but they never want you to control it. So, you know, just to see that, it's just a shame that, you know, we have to fight to get our way up top, even though we're overqualified than the person of another race, and we still can't get there. And it just shows you the dominance and the system that we live in right now. So that's my thoughts on that. Also with the young teen, the young girl crying about being victimized and terrorized at school. And I think this is heartfelt when you hear things like that, especially from children who really, they just want to be out here and be loved by everybody, and to just go to school trying to get an education, and you're walking down the hall and people calling you all type of racial slurs, and it just resonates so much on how systematic racism plays a huge part in mental illness. We always talk about mental illness in the Black community, but people just want to pinpoint on just Black people's issues when really, when you look at it, the prime base of it is systematic racism. That is a huge element of Black mental health issues in our community, as far as, you know, what I see. And it just broke me down when I heard that, man. Because for a teen to get to that stage of crying, you can hear the tears of help, and nobody's offering any kind of assistance, kind of like saying, just suck it up, you know, be big and move on. And it's just so bad. Also, where there was another clip about lips. I call it lip service, because I love how you have the guts when you add that little bit about lip service. When the non-blacks come into contact with blacks, and they're trying to sit back and collate and share cultures, and kind of remind me of a movie called Little Boxes. And in that movie, it was a little biracial child, and he got into the neighborhood, and as soon as the two white girls found out he had some kind of blackness in him, they was like, oh, he's black. Bring him over. Hey, do you do this? Is rap music like this? And it just brought me back to that same movie, like all the curiosity, and instead of, you know, working on the real issues that we need to work on, just continuous lip service, but just doesn't get us anywhere, but just brings us in a total circle. And the last one I want to comment about is the LeBron incident. I really appreciate LeBron. A lot of people give LeBron a lot of flack. They try to compare him to Jordan, but LeBron does a lot of good things behind the scenes for black people. And for him to speak out on it continuously, it just shows you that he is trying to alert people, aware people, especially of our race, but at the same time trying not to put himself in a position where he can knock himself out of doing work that he's continually doing behind the scenes. I think that him saying the Emmett Till was powerful because you don't want to minimize the hate. Like, he could have just left it at an incident that's similar to spray painting on the wall, but for him to bring out Emmett Till, which was the most horrific just murder in U.S. history, period, and for him to bring that, it like really shocked the world. And had he not used Emmett Till, it wouldn't have this big effect that it is now in the talk and the dialogue we have now. And I really appreciate Carol Anderson. I just went out and bought her book, White Rage. And I was just reading a part in the book, and it just resonated with me real good. And in regards to that was a gentleman by Jason Whitlock. He had some attacks on LeBron, and he was saying something about rich people don't go through, that's not their, rich people don't go through racism, that's only for poor people. But LeBron and is going through the same thing that PK Subban is going through, and a lot of people don't know about PK Subban, who is a black hockey player in Montreal who just got traded to Tennessee and actually brought Tennessee to the first championship in franchise history. And he was being called all type of N-words and going through a whole bunch of racial slurs, like it's just mistreatment. And he just had the biggest hockey deal. I think he signed for $8 million for eight years for $72
million. And we'll
so
leave it there.
I just wanted to leave it at that.
Thank you kindly.
That's it. I'll just leave my line.
Other folks that we've not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Hello, everyone. This is Red from Ohio. A few notes that I took. I spoke about my sister before in previous shows, and I was speaking actually to my sister and another family member while I was listening to the segment. And my sister actually told, and I was talking about the Oregon segment where the racist man had assaulted or was verbally assaulting the two Muslim females. And she was actually she had told me that she had read where in Oregon, when they basically wrote into law that black people could not live there, she had said that black people would, if there were black people that still remained in the state after the law was passed, they would get flogged, publicly flogged every 6 months, and then she said also along with hangings and so forth until they left. So I didn't know about that. The other thing was that I was watching News One Now with Roland Martin, and they had like a small clip of one of the victims, one of the, she looked like she was a black female a victim from the Portland incident, and she had said that she felt like it was her fault that those two white men, and the other one was injured. She felt like it was her fault. So I definitely felt that, you know, that just goes along with racist making non-white people still feel like they are the ones to blame when it's a white person attacking another white person to, I guess, quote unquote, defend them. The other thing was that in the school segregation clip, I definitely, VGQ, of course, if these are non-white people, I think they were, if I understood the clip, how they were talking about the Republican commentary. One male had said, well, if he found out there was a person who was a Republican, he would just want to give them a hug. And that just goes along with racist really making us or believe that this nonviolent, loving everyone philosophy will end racism. And the other student had said, well, Republicans don't really even support Trump, which I felt was, you know, and like I said, VGQ. But at first, I was under that impression that, oh, well, Republicans, white Republicans, of course, they're speaking out, they're being opponents of what Trump is doing. Opponents of what Trump is doing. But it's like, especially the best example that I can think of is Paul Ryan, who was running against him, who was using black people when he was speaking out against the terrible things that Trump was doing. I remember seeing on, I think it might have been CNN or MSNBC, he was standing in front of a group of different black people and speaking about how terrible Trump's behavior was, especially during the presidential race. But then not that long ago, I recently saw how Paul Ryan, he was smiling and clapping when Trump announced that he was going to remove Obamacare. The other thing that I wanted to speak about was I did read the newspaper, my local newspaper today, and or recently, and I saw that there was this article about how they're now doing genetic testing on children's genes at it's a hospital in Columbus. It's a children's hospital. And they're trying to test for different diseases and children. That made me think about just what we have been talking about, just genetics and how much it would cost. And they were saying that they have the abilities now to find out, test the different genomes of a child who has some type of affliction. They can reduce the testing time and the results, the time they would get the results from 3 weeks to within a week. So I definitely thought that was, and the thing about it is with Children's Hospital, it's less than 5 minutes away from a predominantly black area, which is basically low income. And they were also in the article, they were talking about how the hospital, they've gotten so many millions of dollars worth of donations. The last thing I wanted to speak about was also in the same newspaper, there was an article about this white nurse who has allegedly killed over 60 children. And the main thing that I wanted to point out was that in the actual newspaper, they were talking about the main focus was a little white baby that she killed by giving her an overdose of a pain, a muscle relaxer. But then they also said that she attempted to kill another little boy. And the newspaper said a little boy, but I had to do further research. And the little boy, his name was Rolando Sanchez, which he could likely be a non-white person. And so I just thought that was definitely an act of racism because it wouldn't have taken that much more space to actually put his name rather than boy in the newspaper. So that's all I wanted to share. Thank you for listening.
great points. Great way. Mm-hmm. Just reading the newspaper can be a great way to exercise your understanding of counter-racism and sometimes how they will omit information, include information that can give clues about racial classification or just other information about the different reports that are going to be included. So great job. Another great reason to stay current with local, national, global affairs. And the history of white supremacy in Portland, obviously it's literally right down the road from me. You can drive from Seattle to Portland in about 3 hours, I think. Rougher, give or take. We've done quite a few programs here on the Cows. As I said, Randy Blazak discussed some of that history. We also did some. I will never forget the night that they announced that Darren Wilson would not be indicted for the murder of Michael Brown Jr. We had white documentary filmmakers on the documentary Portlandia. They were on to discuss that very topic, the history of black people, exactly what she stated. If you were a black person, you're in Portland, you were going to be beaten. You could be beaten, I think it was every 60 days, and literally kicked out of the state if you were a black person. And it helps explain why they don't have very many black people in Oregon now and in this part of the world in general. But we've talked about that extensively on the Cows before, specifically that night back in 2014. Other folks we've not heard from at all.
Can I be heard? Can I be heard?
We'll get Thomas in New York. I also heard Mr. Steele, though. Go ahead, Thomas in New York.
Thank you, guys. I'm about to enter the plantation, so thank you for treating me. Good evening to all the guests. Yeah, I remember that show, and if I recall, the guests wanted to cut the show short so they could go and watch the verdict, if I'm not mistaken. Was that the right guess?
It sounds like that could be correct. I remember the verdict came out. I think they had been on roughly 90 minutes or so. Sounds like that something they might have said, yeah.
Absolutely. Who do you think got a... Well, I don't think it was a dose of racial reality for LeBron, you know, but I'm sure it was one for Tiger Woods, man. He found out he was black this week. I looked at the police report and said, black male. I said, you can't pull a fast one on us anymore. So I thought that was very interesting. The LeBron thing, I thought that what he said was you know, as broad as he could say it, you know, with the conditions that he's under, you know, terms of contracts and things. So I appreciated that he did go out and make a comment, because I was expecting for him not to. So I give him some black self-respect for that. Didn't hear all the clips because I was on the train, and, you know, it's not Wi-Fi on all the stations, so your phone goes in and out. But the clip in Canada where the guy called in, that clip was very interesting. I thought that was, the point of view that he took, the point of view of the average white person in America, Canada, worldwide, I think, as far as when it comes down to people in their country that are not from their country, or people that have come to a country they have conquered. I thought that was a very good clip. I don't know if you played the bill there. I heard someone else speaking about it. And, you know, I mean, as confirmed, I got a call from my grandmother. And she's been one of his biggest advocates all these years. He's racist, and she says he's not. And she was, I can't believe you said that, and you were right. And I was like, yeah, you know. But when you really think about it, and I'll leave it at this. I mean, I used to use that terminology, and I stopped years ago. Really, after I saw the movie Goodbye, Uncle Tom, because I concluded that they had it much worse in the house situation, being under the rulership of their father's mother and their grandparents and their brothers and sisters, and having to serve them, and knowing that they're kin to these people but still a slave. And as we all have concluded, I'm sure most people that watch and listen to the Cows, white women are much more dangerous than white men. And that's the conditions of the house league. And I mean, I want to thank you, Gus.
Appreciate that, Thomas, in New York. Mr. Steele, thank you for your patience, sir.
Awesome, awesome. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Beautiful. I am in Chino Hills. This is Ken Steele, and I just wanted to make a report. I wanted to begin today by saying limit your exposure to television. There is a number of programs that the suspected white supremacists are running that are, I'm believing, are being used to set black people up for tremendous amounts of violence. One of these programs that I see that has been getting a lot of play on television is the program that they are trying to engineer more gun ownership amongst black people. Now, I am not against self-defense for victims of racism. I think that victims of racism should take any and all means that they need to protect themselves. However, it's very, very, very bothersome to me that the same people who have worked tirelessly to keep firearms out of the hands of black people are now leading the leading the effort to get black people to purchase more guns. There are doing this a number of different ways. There's a preponderance of news articles that are highlighting black people getting guns. I don't know what kind of stats that they're using to back up this whole claim that black people, there are increased numbers of black people that are getting guns, but they are reporting this, and I believe it's to encourage black people to arm themselves. They are also pushing victims of racism to advertise guns to what I'm suspecting is an online and younger crowd. One of these victims of racism that they're showcasing to do this is a guy named Madge Torre. And I recently interacted with him on my page, and he couldn't answer why so many suspected racists, including the Republican caucus of, I believe, Minnesota, gave him thousands of dollars to promote his hashtag Black Guns Matter campaign. He's been spotted in photos with characters like Donald Trump Jr. His movement is being pushed by people like Tommy Lauren. And I asked him why so many suspected racists are putting so much money, giving him so much publicity on channels like Fox News, and he could not answer these simple questions. And he was using a lot of profanity, including, I think, using the N-word. If you go to his page, for instance, you can see that he has his merchandise placed next to Jordan's. And this is another thing that I've seen on another victim of racism that's being showcased, Mr. Colin Noir. They'll use materialism. They'll have like a nice watch. They'll have a pair of Jordans, and then they'll show a gun. And I just want to remind victims of racism that this Second Amendment that they keep pushing and keep talking about, it clearly in practice does not apply to victims of racism. I asked this Madge Torre person, the same Republican Party of Minnesota that gave him thousands of dollars to promote Black Guns Matter. It's located in the same state that victim of racism, Philando Castillo, was murdered by a suspected race soldier. And he had a license to carry. He was a legal gun owner, and they have nothing. Colin Noir, this Madge Torre, Black Guns Matter, or the NRA, they have said nothing about this case. They are not advocating for the application of the Second Amendment for black people. It seems like they're just trying to get as many black people to get guns in their hands as possible and be very leery of any racist that is telling you to pick up a gun. They are, I suspect, trying to make victims of racism even more qualified targets for immediate termination. I remember Neely Fuller mentioning that the massacre in Black Wall Street in Tulsa all those years ago was started at a shootout whereby all of the participants were carrying weapons, both Black and both white and non-white. They were all carrying firearms, and they used this as justification to march on the entire community. So be very, very careful about handling firearms, having guns, registering for a list that says that you have a gun. All of these things I would be very, very, very careful about. It seems like they're placing an inordinate amount of energy and money into promoting the idea of Black people getting guns in their hands and feeling entitled, like they can walk around and do all these displays that their suspected racist counterparts are engaging in this time period. And I have other comments, but I will mute my line at this time. Thank you so much.
Other folks that we have not heard from at all who have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Good to hear from you, Roz.
Greetings to you, Gus, to Ken Steele, Thomas in New York, all the other callers and listeners. It's great to be with you this evening. I got to hear some of the clips. The clips were really, really great. And there was, I wanted to comment first on LeBron James, the clip on LeBron James. And like everyone else has previously said, I would like to mirror their sentiments. Just massive amounts of Black self-respect from him as a victim of racism. It's just really, really great to see him take the stance that he has in regards to racism, white supremacy. It just kind of reminds me of Jim Brown and the things that he's also done in other athletes that have decided to, stand up to do the right thing as far as trying to replace the system with the system of justice. One thing that he did say, and of course VGQ, but he did say at one point that racism would never go away. And I definitely agree with him. The only caveat is that, and I think a lot of us as victims sometimes will say things of that sort in regards to racism not going away, but it's really as long as white people are in charge. That's the other half of the statement, in my opinion. As long as white people are in charge, as long as non-white people continue to facilitate bolstering the system of white supremacy by us not changing our behavior in response to what's being done to us, it will never go away. As long as we're convinced that white people will always be in charge, it will never go away. So that was just the caveat I wanted to add to what he said. And then there was a clip you played about interracial marriage that I found very interesting. I didn't get to hear all of the statistical data in regards to what the so-called race mixing looks like. But yes, the Skittles comment caught me too, and a whole bunch of comments they said. But one thing that the white female said that I found very interesting was she had said that interracial, quote-unquote, interracial marriage was outlawed as if intermarriage was like marrying another species. And I found that interesting because that's how they used to view Black people, as we were some subhuman species. And they would use us in that manner. But I find that very interesting that's the term she would use, because you have a lot of people in different European countries, like Germany, for example, where whites want to marry dogs. So you're literally speaking of white people wanting to have sex with other species of animals. They want to rape animals. So I just found that just very, very interesting that she pointed that out. And yet in reality, white people literally want to legally marry other species of animals. So, it just goes to show quite the psychology and psychopathology of the way white people function. Also, just wanted to touch on a couple of things, because today I had gone to an event in Jersey City with my wife. She was selling some of her handbags. She makes makes her own designs and develops her own handbags and her own textiles. So she was selling some of the stuff at a jazz festival today. And it was really great to be around so many Black people and non-white people in a positive setting as far as just the atmosphere. No one's getting into any sort of negativity. But I saw so many things about, and that's why the interracial clip really stuck with me. I have not seen so many tragic arrangements in my life in one place. I mean, whites with Asians, whites with Black people, and I mean, some of the most beautiful crystal Black women, I mean, I've seen in a long time, with these just these diabolical white males that looked very effeminate. They were pouring all over them. I mean, as far as just putting their hands all over them and touching on them and feeling on them. And oh, it was just really nauseating to be in that atmosphere and watch that take place. And then the people, some of the Black people who were not with white people, they were with another Black person. Just the interactions between them and to see how white people insert themselves in our culture is just nauseating. You could tell they didn't belong. They had no soul. They had no rhythm. They were just there, and they were just like the thing that didn't belong, that was just all over and everywhere and just all involved. It was just nauseating to watch. But there was one thing I saw that blew my mind. When I saw it, I thought of you immediately. There was a young Black male. He looked like he could have been a product of miscegenated union. And he was walking with this white woman who I just assumed that was his mother. She might not have been his mother, but it was two white women. One was the older one. One was kind of like, I guess, middle-aged, a little less than middle-aged. And he was following them, and his behavior struck me as very awkward because of the way he was behaving. And at one point, the two white women were having a discussion, and he looked like he could have been between 8 and 10 years old, and he was standing next to the woman who I thought was his mother because she was the younger one of the two. And she literally folded her arm as if she was on an armrest and put her elbow on his shoulder and kind of was leaning on his head. And he stood there like almost like an obedient animal while she's leaning on him like he's an armrest while she's standing up conversing with the other white woman that they were with. And I just said, oh, my goodness, he's literally become a human, inanimate object for her. And he was so psychologically conditioned that he literally went and stood next to her. And when she did it, he stood there just as calm as if it was just the most incredible thing I'd ever seen. I'd never seen a young child who exhibited that sort of behavior with this white woman. And just made me think of all the other guests that you've had and callers that have called in that were, had a white parent, and they would talk about the abuse and the racism and white supremacy that the white parent would exhibit upon them. And I just saw that as the most blatant and overt form of white supremacy ever, to use him as an inanimate object. And the fact that he was mentally trained to stand there and do so. So it looked like it was something she's been doing for a long time. That's all. I just wanted to chime in with that. And hopefully I'll get to chime in later as people speak about some of the clips that I missed. Thank you for another great program, Gus. And I'll meet my line.
Ashe, report from his outing in New York. Tragic arrangements abound. Other folks that we've not heard from at all, other people that we've not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, line should be open. I think some folks still might have a hand up and are remaining silent while... we see if any of those folks, oh, wait a minute, might have missed a hand or two as well. Any folks that we've missed completely? Not sure.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. I think only to think about two audio segments right now. The first one, I believe it was the BBC, because I think I heard the English accents. It was interesting how the guy that was like presiding over the discussion or whatnot, he was, I think, intentionally and strategically interrupting a lot of the people who was trying to speak. I'm not sure. He may have done that to one of the white people in the audience, or for that matter, but especially like a lot of the black speakers, I noticed he would jump in or interject inappropriately when they were trying to make a point, and he would get them to go into speaking about something else. And the questions he would ask brought about, in my opinion, a bunch of confusion. Like, what does, like when he says, well, you know, can a black person be racist toward Polish? You know, he went into using words that describe a body of land. That's how I always think about it. He got away from, you know, whether or not someone's white or not, and then tried to throw in the religious, different religious groups. And it was, I agree with you that they were able to counter those sneaky, you know, nefarious attacks, you know, that they try to bring into the conversation. And then it seems like when you pretty much know how to articulate and explain racism, they really begin to speak less and less. And that reminds me of, I think that was the guy, a victim of racism, Shannon Sharp, who's been speaking on the race issue a lot. And I noticed that Skip Bayless, he's never really doing much talking about the racism issue. Like, he probably can speak about different athletes and different sports situations and stuff, but they tend to let the victim do the speaking as though he's the expert or they're the expert. And, you know, we do know how to articulate and interpret the problem, but I think the white people, you know, obviously knows a whole lot more about it than we do. And I think that's another strategic behavior, pattern of behavior they exhibit. And I didn't get to catch that part where the guy called into the radio station of the guy in Canada, but it did seem like he was using that same cliche argument that they like to use when you bring up the police or the law enforcement issue and how they interact with non-whites. And as far as they were talking about the intermarriage or whatever, that seemed very confusing to me as well. How they just say, well, you know, well, we can just all just, I guess, have sex and then, you know, it'll pretty much, we'll have quote unquote mixed babies. Like, they didn't really get into any kind of detailed explanation as to what groups of people are doing this, what they say, intermarrying or whatever. Like, they didn't list any names. And one last thing I wanted to mention is when in that BBC interview, they used the word class, but that's confusing too, because racism is about classifying people. So they'll say race and class, but you're already classifying people. So class and classifying, classification, those pretty much similar terms, but they'll use it, you know, they'll put it next to each other to make it seem like it's two different things just to confuse you. So that's all I have for now, and thanks for allowing me to speak.
Confusion. That is something master deceivers excel at, using words to generate confusion. And whites, no one does it better all around the world, especially when they begin to talk about racism. And I don't watch Skip Bayless purposely, just for a variety of reasons, but I have seen him before, and I've noted the same pattern when they have him talking with another non-white person and the subject becomes racism. They'll have the non-white person be the one who talks as though they're the expert, and Skip Bayless, who normally has a lot to say, becomes very, very quiet
and, you know, will just defer to the non-white person as though they're the expert. And, you know, I don't really, you know, have a whole lot other than, you know, I'm Skip Bayless. And, you tell him, bro. That's going to be kind of his, that's what I've seen, which very shrewd move from the racist man, suspected racist man. Other folks that we've not heard from at all. We get everybody, anybody that we missed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Greetings, everybody. This is Amy. I do apologize for taking so long to be able to speak, but there's a lot going on over here at the plantation. So, but anyway, I enjoyed this evening's broadcast. I felt that there was a lot I could pay attention to, particularly in how whites maneuver in their system of white supremacy and how subtle it really is, but how powerful it is at the same time. And one of the clips, my goodness, it was the very early one. I was kind of, you know, getting ready for work and stuff, so my notes are not as detailed, but the interviewer, this white male interviewer, says that, you know, I know everything is not the perfect way, but he says, I'm sure you've seen things change. And he posed that kind of as a question. And the non-white victim responded and was like, yeah, it's not, and I have seen things change. Like, and the point that I'm getting to is that that's leading. When you do that, when you're questioning, that's leading. And it's so subtle, but what happens is, like, there are studies that show, depending on how you frame your question, the person responding will answer the answer that she wants them to without necessarily having given it a lot of thought. And so I think that interviewer did that, and I paid attention to it when it happened, but I think that that's happening more often than not when talking with white people, because I, like, everyone's under the impression that there have been changes. And I'm not really so sure, outside of this so-called having sex with white people thing being acceptable. I think, like, that might be what all of this is based on when people say that there's so much change or that they've seen things change. So, but anywho, I kind of paid a little bit of attention to how news functions psychologically and what it does. And so I think that when, in listening to the clip with the young female who started crying because of the terror that she's experiencing at school, I think that confirms for white people that what they're doing is successful. I think that that's, like, one of the ways that they're transmitting their information. That's why they're highlighting so many times, so often, when we are very emotionally vulnerable and expressive in our vulnerability. But I also think that simultaneously it conditions non-white people to tap into, like, a group feeling of fear. It conditions as it continues to shape us, in addition to being informative, like, we need to know that. But I think that that's one of the things that the news does. And then I agreed with Gus. Like, I was very happy when Gus mentioned that early clip that said the system had been set up, you know, hundreds of years ago, but maintained every day, every moment. That's why it is how it is. So I thought that's one of those other ways that white people are practicing racism on a very subtle psychological level, and how things are being framed with the words and the word choice that they use. And then, did someone actually say eyeballing in one of the clips? Like, a white person refer to black people as eyeballing? But anywho, and then the last thing, or let's see here. Okay. And then I've let everybody know I'm the one in the DMV area. So I used to actually work, like, where walking distance to the Smithsonian, the monument, all that good stuff. And there's a really big food place to eat. And so when all of the kids come down to go to the museums, they all go to this area. It has the Five Guys, it has the Qdoba, you know, and then they get vouchers, white or black, everybody's getting vouchers, and that's how the schools take the buses over there, and they generate all this money in, over there for their expensive hamburgers. Well, I used to, that's where I would eat lunch. I'd pack my lunch, but that's where I would go sit. And I would observe these white youth and these black youth and how they are interacting with one another. And I used to always see how, and I used to wonder how this is possible because I didn't hear the clip that I heard today. So I would see these groups of like white kids and then like a one or two black children in the mix. And pardon me, I have to just make sure that everybody's okay. I'm sorry. I do apologize, but the plantation is busy, so whatever. So I used to pay attention, and so I'd notice how the white kids are pretty much like throwing shade to the black kids. And I'd be like, but if y'all go to school together, like, why are you even trying to sit with this person or have lunch with this person? Now, here we go. Lo and behold, these students, maybe some of them, like in the majority white school, will have some black people and there, but not, you know, that's just one aspect. But it could very well be that I was observing when there's these all-white populations of students mixing with these black populations of students in some kind of effort or whatever, and what you're looking at is that behavior pattern as it expresses itself, pretty much like, okay, we're all here together, but I don't really like you. And even though the black people are always, we're always open trying to like think that if we teach white people it'd be nice, white people it'd be nice to us, the children have the same thought, but white kids already know, like, no, I don't really rock with you. And the only times that I would see the black kids really being accepted is when they were performing whatever stereotype it is that was best, easiest for them to slip into and that they got rewarded from. Everyone picks one that they can use and put on, and the children are no different. So I would observe that. But then also, they said that the black kids are like the white kids, oh, you're cool. And, you know, what I would also see is white kids performing. And so I don't, you know, like that clip for me expressed nothing other than how well children can pass with each other, or like they don't have an understanding, so they're not having a real conversation. And I think that's very important. I think that whole thing is all about conditioning the youth to formulate how they're going to think about this problem in the future, which is what they've begun at the college institutional level. I was able to observe by using things like in words like implicit bias and so forth. But by bringing black kids and white kids together in this kind of fake environment and then having them talk a little bit, that's just to help like shape the mind to make sure it's how you want it to be in the future and not too revolutionary. But anyway, so like all a white kid would have to do is be like, oh yeah, I listen to trap. And next thing you know, we'd be like, oh my God, you're so cool. I had no idea. I thought everybody just listened to rock, and that's not true. A lot of people don't realize that white people are the ones who are consuming the music. So, and that's how the white people will pass with the kids. I used to observe that a lot too. But I am very grateful for all of the clips. And just a thought that I'm having. People can comment later, think about it, whatever, or not. It is what it is. That I'm observing that they're like right now there's some type of like split between the white people, which may have always been there, may not, but right now I think it's evident because I'm constantly thinking about why is it that these, let me get to the point. White people miss like raping their niggers. I think those are the ones that are intermarrying. And it's only because they can't go and rape the way that they did that now they're like, well, I'll just go ahead and so-called marry and have kids and do all this. So there's a split between the white people who are like, no, you're not supposed to do that, and the ones that are like, screw that, I miss my nigger. And that's what they're doing. And so, you know, I'm not really sure what the ultimate, like, how this will all play out. But I could totally see, and I got a chill in my chest while I was driving listening, because if that's the case, everybody, they want to make this whole mulatto population group of people, and I think they want to graft it in some genetics. We're not the majority here. Non-white people are the majority, but we're not, black people are not the majority. And so in this particular country now, like I think I used to frame this in thinking that all black people will be wiped out all at the same time, and I don't think that that's true. I think it's very possible that the whites here have decided that they are going to graft in as much genetic material that they want, because I think at this point scientifically, like they're very logical people, they have deduced that they need it, and then they will figure out what to do with the rest of us niggers that they don't want. the two dark ones, and that will become the new class of colored, and that'll just be the whitening of America some more. And then the last thing, there was a caller, I think he was in Virginia, he said he did something with the broadcasting and radio and something or whatever, and I kept meaning to, like, get this to him, but he said that Richard Spencer was going to be on some broadcast, some place, and people were going to be asking him questions, and if we had any questions, to offer up a question. This was maybe a couple of weeks ago, so I might have missed this boat. I hope not. But if so, the question that I think I'd like to ask Mr. Spencer, if given the opportunity, is what does he think should be done with the black people? He doesn't want any mixing or whatever. I just want to know, what does he think should be done? So if you're listening and you have the opportunity to ask him that, I would greatly appreciate it. And I thank you all for listening.
Appreciate that, Emmy. Wow. I'll have to ponder on, I guess, the different motivations for racists and their sexual exploitation of non-white people. I'll ponder on that. Tends to be one of folks' favorite areas of study, so I'm sure some people would be more than happy to volunteer their opinion on that subject matter. The children's segment, which some folks did mention, I know we have parents who listen to the program. The segment where the children were talking about the abuse that they suffered, we heard the one black female where she was saying that it was a white student that she thought was her friend who was engaged in all of this. Extremely important. I recommend you could take those and you'll find easy. It'll be, you know, 2-3 of those types of incidents every week. And I thought the school year was basically over, at least in the States, but every week there'll be 2 or 3 of those type of incidents that happen at the school. You can use that to help teach, inform your offspring about racism, white supremacy. Just those type of clips right there so that they're not surprised, so that they're not stunned. And maybe even you can keep them from having, quote unquote, white friends to begin with. Maybe, just maybe. Just sitting down, have an honest dialogue about racism. Other folks that we've missed completely, if you have a hand up, we've not heard from you at all, line should be open.
Hello, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, greetings to everyone on the line. I did not hear the clip about the young, I guess, teenagers who were being abused by who they thought were their friends. But it did remind me that when my son was going to school, he had a similar experience. But I had been talking to him about what to expect when he entered this particular school and when we would go to stores, you know, like the surface stuff. But I never really truly got into a clear understanding of what it is what it is to be a white person. And now that I'm getting a better understanding, he's grown now. We have lots of talks about stuff like this, but he went to a particular school in upstate New York, and I had my nephew for a while, and he also attended the same school. Now, he was abused basically pretty much the same way that my son was. He's called a nigger. Don't touch me. I don't want your skin to rub off on me. And I mean, my son, he was fine. I know it kind of damaged him, but he was able to talk to me about it and we kind of worked it through. But now, I think he was about 10 when this happened to him. But my nephew was 7 and he got on, went to the same school, got on a school bus, and was called by white child, you're a bitch-ass nigga. And, of course, I took it to the school to try to get some resolution. But, you know, I just had to sit down and explain to my nephew the things that were going to happen to him, the things that he should not be surprised at. And he got what I was talking about, but he was still, his mind is still like, why is it like that? Why do I have to be aware
why do I have to, you know, keep my guard up when I'm around these people? I don't think he completely understands, but he does know that there's a huge difference between himself and white people. And it's just sad that children have to go through that. But I think it's best that we try to, as attentive parents, to have the conversation. And it's not really a difficult conversation to have because they're going to run up against it. But and I think for me, getting a better understanding of what it means to be white helps an awful lot. And the clip about the rainbows, I kind of cringed on that one because I was having a conversation with someone about that particular thing. And my stand is I'm cordial to white people, but I don't want them in my area. I don't want them to invade my territory. I mean, if I got to go to the store and I got to deal with them, okay, that's fine. But I don't want them in my home. I don't have that kind of connection. And I was told by a friend that, this person, he has a friend that's white. And I'm that's what he calls him, a white friend. I don't consider white people friends, and I express that to him, but I'm just expressing what he said to me. He has a white friend, and his white friend wants to get to know me. And I'm like, well, you know how I feel about white people. This is probably never, ever going to happen. And, it got to the point where we were almost in conflict with one another. And I had to stop, and I said, did you see what just happened? You allow this white person to enter into your area, and all he did was cause conflict and confusion because now we're almost at each other's throats. And he had to stop, he stepped back, he thought about it, and he understood the reason why I don't want to have that kind of connection, but I think he's finally starting to see what it means to be white, and I think that is a good thing. And also the clip on with Esther Stanford. What is her? Am I saying that right?
Esther Stanford Kosei.
Ah, yes, that was beautiful. Maybe it's only in Britain or in England, but I've never really heard any non-white person in the States speak in the manner in which she spoke. And the doctor, I loved when he's told the interviewer, "Boy, you're doing this, having conflation and confusion." I thought that was outstanding, and I would certainly love to see them or hear them back on your program. So, if that's a possibility at all, that would be great. And I think that's all. Thank you.
For sure. For sure. Definitely continue those conversations. I think you said it was your nephews, or young nephew at least. Continue, keep those dialogues up. And even if you have older children, keep those conversations up too. That's great. But I think that's so key if anyone who has younger, if they're your children or just younger children, period, that you have contact with, you talk to them or what have you, you brought up racism, to have it be a regular thing that's encouraged. Same way we do here, where you're talking to them and encouraging them to talk to you if they, you know, see something, if something happens, or if they're just thinking about things, to kind of encourage keeping that dialogue open. That can be very helpful. And as I said, you can use these incidents to help you share so that they kind of know how widespread this is, how much of a problem this is, and to kind of rehearse different ways that that they get response, or if you want to respond, or if you want to share any suggestions, what have you. Other folks that we've missed completely, any folks that we've missed completely, haven't heard from? I know Thomas in New York said he had a hand up as well. Thomas in New York, did you have additional commentary?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Okay, great. Thank you, Gus. Man, my call, when I go to get to certain parts of the hospital, the machines knock out my phone signal, so I have to call back in, so I apologize for that. One of the callers was talking about how some of the ways that the kids are able to get in, and how they mistreat black kids, but also just how they're able to use the music and things to be called the cool white person or whatever. And it was so funny because yesterday, and it was by no choice of mine, I was just too lazy to get up and get the controller, so I sat down and watched the whole movie called The Cotton Club. Did you ever see that movie, Gus?
No, sir.
With Gregory Hines and what's the guy, Richard Gere, Lawrence Fishburne's in it. It's about early 1920s, early 19th century. I guess that would be the 20th century. But Harlem and the Cotton Club, which was owned by these white gangsters, and all the acts were black. I mean, so they've always been able to latch on to our musical culture, and that was pretty much that thing they had in common. And they used it to manipulate the black people, and the black people couldn't go and see their own people perform. But it was a movie that was, looking at it, my eyes, it was all about racism. So I was very happy I watched it, and I would suggest other people to watch it. But just went to how long this is going on, where they've gotten into our music and used that to get into our midst, and eventually to have more control over us. And when she brought that up, I thought that was very interesting. And I mean, well, I think.
Appreciate that. I think I've heard of that film before, but I haven't watched it myself. Just to make sure folks do not get excited, we still do not do TV movies on the compensatory call-in, and the reason explanation, because I found that in the system of white supremacy, victims watch a lot of television. We are looking for an escape from the terrorism. And racism is always going to be there. It doesn't matter if you're watching cartoons, documentaries, the news, sitcoms, Thursday night specials. The racism is going to be there. So you can always, find elements of racism, white supremacy in any broadcast. So people just end up having, we just end up having an endless list of, films, TV shows that people want to discuss. And I don't think that's the most constructive investment of time and energy. So just make sure folks don't get excited to mention other shows and viewing material they've seen over the last few days. Much obliged. That segment with the children, I just wanted to say really quick, the segment where they were talking about the Republicans, like they did, the one student, he said he had never met anybody that was Republican, and I guess some of the people that say that they are Republican, they make sure to say that they don't support Donald Trump. I thought that was equally dangerous. I think the Young Turks, they made similar comments in that segment, and implying that conservatives or Republicans, that those types oppose quote-unquote interracial marriage, and that we're winning. Those types, they're losing. It's not even that many of them left. That's really, really dangerous. Any talking or communication that suggests that only Republicans are racists, that white people that are not Republicans, they're not racist, that they're cool, that they might be down to marry you, have sex with you if you're a non-white person, they don't like Donald Trump, they're not racist. That is very, very dangerous, a very, very ignorant way of thinking about the system of white supremacy. I know Dr. Welsing, she used to say regularly, you just have two different political parties with regards to racism, white supremacy, but it's all a part of the whole system of white supremacy. Very important to keep that in mind, and just because it's promoted, it's so common in the way that people talk about racism, that it's only Republicans that are racist. Not true. Very dangerous. Other folks that we've and the noose at the National Museum, I still haven't been there, but I did think that was very important, the noose being found at the National Museum of African American history at the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. They just dedicated it. I think it was last autumn. President Obama was there, and they had lots of other folks. I think George Bush was there. George W. Bush was there, amongst many other luminaries, quote unquote. I thought that was really important as well. And they used some of the same verbiage. You know, it's 2017, and this is still happening. Other folks, any other comment? We have about 30 minutes left. Please do not wait till the last minute. The number 641-715-3640, code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Other commentary folks wanted to make sure they got in before we concluded. If you spoke before, that's fine. Just if you had any additional comments you wanted to get in.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, thanks again for taking my call, Gus. Yeah, just thinking about what Thomas in New York was just discussing, when I thought about the event today that I was that I attended, it was interesting because when I saw these white people trying to call themselves dancing, because they had like Latin jazz as well as original African-American jazz or American African jazz. And what I thought about was Malcolm X, when he discussed the early stages of black music, where he would go to these clubs and dance the Lindy Hop. And it was originally basically all black people attending these events. And then as white people started to go to these underground clubs to partake of these events, that a lot of these clandestine, miscegenated relationships would take place in these spaces. And when I was looking at the event, I just like kind of stood, kind of took a look from a different view. And I thought about it, and I'm like, well, it's not that they're experiencing another group, another non-white people's culture. They're consuming it. It's just another form of delectable Negro. For the moment, I can be around you, you know, you non-white people, you niggers, and you know, I can partake and consume your culture, act like I'm enjoying it. And then because there were so many quote unquote interracial couples, they can go home and then consume their niggas in the bedroom. That's exactly how I was thinking about it. It's just they're consuming our culture, they're eating it, they're spewing it, they're just doing whatever they need to do to enjoy watching us perform. That's the only capacity with which they can stand to be in our presence, is if we're doing something that they find enjoyable that we are able to give to them. And it's basically, it's always a transfer of energy from us to them, transfer of spirit from us to them, transfer of physical person from us to them, transfer of our organs from us to them, them eating us, you name it. It's just always a one-way transfer, us to them, us to them, us to them. And the only thing that they transfer from them to us is white supremacy. And I think just that whole idea of non-white people being in any sort of cultural arena where white people are there and are somehow partaking of the culture is just an allowance of them to consume us. And for those of us who choose to be in tragic arrangements, we then allow them to further consume us in whatever private capacity once we're in close proximity for them to practice the worst form of terrorism there is, which is sexual abuse and rape of black people. So I just wanted to chime in with that. Thanks again, and I'll mute my line.
Appreciate that, Roz. Wow. Wow. Other folks have additional comments that they wanted to add.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
2812 from Virginia. Yeah, just a quicker, I want to respond to Emmy. I wrote the question down. Probably the best question Mr. Fuller advises us to even ask is what should be done with Negroes? Fantastic question. So I'll definitely make a note. He'll be back on the show maybe in a couple of months. I know he's doing his racist, white supremacist collegiate tour, and Mr. Spencer is running around and giving out false information. I agree with Roz. I also think that in reference to the interracial relationships, I think the one thing that, using logic, is that the non-white person is still not the most powerful person in the relationship ever, no matter what. So there's no, there's never a transfer of power. It's just all that person is always a victim, even if they're married, even if they pass down wealth or anything. That I just think that they're always going to be a victim. Period. End of story. Always going to happen. And that's all I wanted to share.
Right on. Right on.
Can I say something, Gus?
Yes, sir.
But if you were going to say something, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, proceed.
Oh, okay. First, I wanted to just make sure I got the whole gist of the question that Emmy asked earlier. I believe it was her who asked the question in regards to black people and white people together, I believe, or something to that effect. And I just wanted to thank Roz for chiming in, because what he just said was so, he put it right in, it's consumption. And I just wanted the question, because I did have an answer, but I'm not sure. My answer started to, like, I wrote it down, and it's not making sense. So I'm like, let me rehear the question, because, yeah.
I see. Is Emmy available to...
Is that posed to me?
Yeah, to give us the question again to make sure we got it clear.
I'm going to be very honest. I'm not exactly sure how I framed the question. I just know the thing that I'm thinking about. So forgive me if it's not exactly the same way that I didn't write it down. But I know what I'm seeking is feedback or people's thoughts on... the purpose of the interracial, what they call an interracial dating. Is that what you're referring to, that part, just before I start talking a whole lot?
Yeah, because what I wrote down was to ask you if you have observed, which I have observed, when I do see these couples in tragic arrangements, the white male, and it's an actual, like, he's in a real relationship with the black female. The black female tends to be very culturally, looks like, afro, dreadlocks, seems to be very black, like, culturally black. You know, like, she seems like she's culturally aware. And then you see her with this white man, and it's like, whoa. And I just wanted to know if you, that's why I was like, I wrote this down, but it's not making sense while we're asking this. But now that you reframed your question, it's starting to come back to me.
It makes complete sense to me. And yes, I have observed that, particularly within the academic institution. That's very, very easy to see. And oftentimes when I was far more confused and really just being indoctrinated by the institution, I had no idea about these women. I was like, oh my God, you know, and then the minute I found out they had a white husband, I was like, you're lying. You fraud, pretty much. That's not how I would frame it now. But yes, I do find that. And I myself have been approached. I guess I could be classified as one of those women that you're talking about, especially in terms of like my physical appearance. I've one time had locks. I've even been shaved, like, all the way down, like, 1.5, and then I've had froze. So, like, in different stages, white people have approached me like that, and I think for that very reason. But I think it's interesting because one of the things I was going to say if I had a chance to comment again is I think that white female with the Turks, I think she said something really, really, really important about, I think it was the white Turks, whatever, the white one that was talking about Skittles. She said that she doesn't want to be with someone exactly like her because she can't learn. That was, you know, she's like, I like learning from these other non-white people that I am having sex with. And so I thought about, like, how that functions because that's a very intimate level, and white people know that. And these are not, like, white people who are oftentimes ostracized by their white counterparts. These are white people who report back to white people, and that's exactly what I think that they're doing in part of, in first part, getting genetic material, so that they can procreate and get all these things that they decided that they want genetically. And then secondly, to gather
very like hidden information that people will talk about, but it goes even deeper, like in addition to just raping. But I think information gathering is something else. And so if I put your question with what I was thinking, I think that's very accurate that these white men are very skillful, deliberate in selecting these particular types of black women who they can shape and mold to be something like, well, to be agents, essentially, but also they function as agents to gather information. So, but yeah.
And this is a great illustration of why, in addition to no television, we also had the no Area 8 for the compensatory call-in, because as I've stated for years, it will dominate the discussion. And something about that to me is just is massively incorrect. I've never seen the same effect happen with with education or economics or workplace racism, where a subject will just dominate the rest of the broadcast. And I've seen it consistently with Area 8, as though we've never talked about this before. We've had lots of broadcasts. So we will be moving on from that topic for the day. If you had additional commentary on that, oh well, you'll have to save it for another time. In addition, since people did bring up the situation with Bill Maher, as I said, I did watch it. I was not surprised. I didn't even include it in the audio because Bill Maher has been spending so much time moping and complaining about Donald Trump that, you know, it's difficult for me to tolerate watching it for too long. But I watched that part. And just I immediately thought this could be some sort of media stunt to get attention, because he says racist things all the time. I've played many of them over the years. I wasn't, you know, particularly stunned about this. Don't really think it's the worst that I've heard over the years that I've been listening. But I have seen the response. People were commenting on my Facebook page and elsewhere as soon as, you know, everything happened last night. I saw this today. Bill Maher strongly rebuked by HBO Ben Sasse, the senator who was speaking with them. So I'll read the report. It says, following Friday night's edition of Real Time, it was pretty clear that the show's host would be further under fire. He dropped the he said nigger. He called himself a house nigger in the midst of a conversation with Senator Ben Sasse, hope I'm saying his name correctly, one that stunned both his guest and most of the audience. Sasse's expression was one of pure awkward shock, not quite knowing what to do with himself. The fact that he didn't come down on Bill Maher right away following the remark is what now has him in hot water. Following the show, Senator Sasse released a series of posts on Twitter in which he tried to explain what was going through his head at the time. Number one, I'm a First Amendment absolutist. Comedians get latitude to cross hard lines. Number two, but free speech comes with a responsibility to speak up when folks use that word. Me just cringing last night wasn't good enough. Three, here's what I wish I'd been quick enough to say in the moment. All in quotes. Hold up. Why do you think it's okay to use that word? The history of nigger is an attack on universal human dignity. It's therefore an attack on the American creed. Don't use it. That's what he wishes he had said, Senator Sasse, but he didn't say any of that. He proceeded with their conversation. So this is back to the report. Meanwhile, HBO strongly condemned Maher's use of the word in a statement of their own. Bill Maher's comment last night was completely inexcusable and tasteless. We are removing his deeply offensive comment from any subsequent airings of the show. Now, that I do not support at all. If he said it, I want it to be there. I put the word nigger back in clips. If someone is accused of saying he called me a nigger or whatever the case may be, if they bleep it out, sanitize it, I put it back in. That's a major part of the problem with racism, white supremacy. Too much is diluted, and every time it helps white people because it hides, it cleans up how pathological and repulsive their conduct is with regards to black people. But I'm going to make an effort right now to make sure that I download the original so that I have it, and encourage other folks to do the same. I do not support that when white people practice racism and just do what they do, and then people try and go back. That's why I don't support them taking the statues down, any of that other nonsense. To many out there calling for Maher's dismissal, a simply strongly worded statement is not going to be enough. HBO could still opt to do more, but for the time being, this is all they've chosen to do. Maher clearly made the statement hoping to get a rise out of people, but the problem is that there was no need to do it within this context. And there's never a reason to do it with such language. The ball's in HBO's court now, but in the event they keep Mar, the bottom line will be what matters most. If this controversy leads to lower ratings, they'll likely move on. Remember that they are not a subscriber-based network, so they don't have the concern of losing sponsors over it. Again, when I first saw this, I thought this was all some sort of media stunt. That's why I didn't even, you know, decide to include it. We shall see. But I am going to download the episode to make sure that I have it if they're going to be trying to snip this out from future broadcasts. Folks have anything else they want to get in? We have about 10 minutes left. Please don't wait till the last minute. Any other comments folks want to get in? Heard, let's get a female caller first, and then we'll get Mr. Steele.
Ah, good. That is the person I want to direct my question to. I have a carry conceal permit, and I've had it for a little while, but I don't carry at all. I just go to the range, and I just, you know, practice shooting the targets. But maybe I'm just not informed, but I did not know that there was this huge push to arm non-white people. Are we talking legally? And you're thinking that if we go and we get these carry conceal permits, we purchase a firearm, we go have it registered, that we are the people who register these guns are going to be the targets of some new scheme that the white supremacists have cooking? I mean, I'm a little lost as to why you said what you said about the whole arming black people. Could you help me out with that?
The logic I'm using is that the people who are pushing for black people to get these so-called legal firearms, they are the same groups of people who historically have sought to limit the access of these firearms. So if a group of people or an individual does a complete reversal in their behavior, that to me is grounds for suspicion. And also the preponderance of the narrative that black people ought to arm themselves because of, you know, the boogeyman Trump or because of heightened fears of racism. To me, it suggests that somehow the news is pushing for us to shoot it out at this for some, you know, shoot it out with racists. And I don't know of too many examples of victims of racism successfully defending against racism with firearms. I just don't see that example existing in history. So combined with, you know, all of the context clues that I'm seeing and the concerted effort behind this message and this push, I'm very suspicious, and I would suggest that other victims have heightened suspicion as well. You know, your concealed carry permit is not going to stop a racist from taking your gun from your person and putting it in your face. So I know a lot of people that do their weapons training, but they don't have the physical stamina to withstand a very pointed attack from a racist or a race soldier that is determined to kill them. So I don't see too many examples of these firearms benefiting black people. More often than not, I see that firearms are used by victims of racism against other victims of racism. I do not feel positive about what I'm seeing coming from these circles. And I just wanted to include Gus, it's a good recommendation that you keep on making, that we limit our exposure to television. I've seen victims of racism in reaction to this Bill Maher situation. You know, they're calling this comedy. They're saying that this is just funny, and they're saying that, you know, this is humor. And one thing that I see that is commonly brought up is that, hey, we aren't going to sit here and censor the television programs from the 1970s and the movies that we saw in those days as well, simply because they say racist things. And I will argue that the racists have successfully programmed victims of racism to seeing the victimization of Black people and the flippant dismissal of Black humanity as comedy. I would argue that a lot of what we call Black culture was actually written by a person named Norman Lear and a person named Mel Brooks. And I would argue that because that these people are responsible for forming our opinions on what is comedy and what is funny, we can hear a suspected race soldier utter the N-word and play that off as some sort of joke. And then we can treat the image of a severed head of a suspected race soldier. We can treat that as some sort of threat to our safety or not comedy. So that's just something that I would advise victims of racism to avoid. Avoid this TV. They are programming us to laugh at our own destruction.
Appreciate that, Mr. Steele. Any final comments before we get ready to wrap up? We have about 5 minutes left in the broadcast. Any final comments?
Yeah, I just want to say to go along with the Black gun ownership, it just seems very odd that they're pushing for this at the same time the current administration is asking prosecutors to not hand out minimum sentences anymore. They want them to any crime to be sentenced to the maximum. And in states like New York, New Jersey, where you're not able to carry a firearm or have one, could mean the difference between you doing 2 years or 3.5 years to doing 8 to 8.5 years. So I just feel like that push could be something to backfire on us. I would advocate if you can get a gun by legal means, do it that way. And I'll meet my line. Thank you.
Right on. Anybody else have a commentary they wanted to make sure they get in before we wrap things up?
All right, can that be heard?
Yes, sir.
Thanks again for allowing me to speak, Gus. I do apologize. I didn't even know that I was unmuted and was making noise on the line, so I do apologize. But I did have one last thing I wanted to implore Black people, everyone within earshot, that whenever you're out in public, especially when the streets are very crowded, please be on alert for these psychotic drivers. That is something that has been happening quite often lately, whether it's in the United States, in London. Sometimes they're white terrorists, sometimes they're non-white people who are doing this, but they're plowing into people with their vehicles and basically trying to take out as many people as possible. So, once this started to become a more, I was always alert anyway. Just the way that I function is just to be in prisoner of war mode, psychologically speaking. But I'm even more heightened on alert now, just due to the fact that this is the new approach to killing large numbers of people that these psychos are taking. So just be very careful, whether you're at an event, whether you're out shopping, if you're in, let's say, a downtown area and the streets are just crowded, just be hyper vigilant about the vehicles and who's driving and erratic drivers. So that way, God forbid, if something does happen, that you're alert enough to be able to maybe remove yourself from the line of danger before something happens, because I have a feeling this is going to grow at an exponential rate, and it just seems to be happening quite often and all over the place now. So just be wary. That's all I wanted to throw out there. Thank you so much, and I'll mute my line.
Great recommendation. It is extremely dangerous. They have been promoting that study about how difficult it is for black people to cross the street and what have you, as though that's a surprise. Definitely be mindful of that. Might even be good to keep that in mind when weekly, each program rather, someone talks about the importance of remaining sober. Something you could kind of keep that in mind as well. You have lots of aggressive, reckless drivers, aggressive, reckless, and racist drivers out on the streets. Might be good to be sober so that you can make sure that you're avoiding them, not being run over. Anybody got anything they need? They can get in within about 60 seconds.
Can I be heard?
Oh, go ahead, Emmy.
Mine's just a quick question, Gus. If you could, tell me how you feel about this or what you think about this. One of the black women, she said that people who have not been racialized as white, do you think that that's a confusing way to conceptualize it, or is that accurate? Is that a good way to speak about it, to say that people who have not been racialized as white? That's it. Thanks.
I've heard that type of phrasing used before, racialized identities. In my view, I think sometimes that sort of language comes out of when we are afraid about how white people are going to respond and if what we're saying might upset them. So we use that sort of language. I think unless I'm in error, my interpretation, certainly VGQ, but my interpretation would just be, hey, people classified as white, whites. We can just make it clear, direct, who we're talking about, racialized. People classified as white, whites, moving forward with what it is. The other caller, maybe we can get her back on the program. We can ask her that directly. The male caller who also spoke up, did you have a quick question or comment?
Yeah, quick comment. This is Royce. Medical apartheid that just occurred, racist whites, the other day, 15 Sudan children were just killed by botched measles vaccination. And all the 15 children were under the age of 5. And they said that this was a vaccination campaign that they targeted for 300 children. So out of 300 children, 15 of them died. And they're saying that campaign is supposed to target 2 million worldwide. And if it does that, that's 100,000 children that would be dead. So just showing you population control under the systematic white supremacy. That's it.
Wow. Lots to be informed about.
I just wanted to add in, I saw that it's breaking news. It's another terrorist attack in London. I don't know if that just happened. It says breaking news here. I was in the room. I just thought that was interesting.
Yes, that happened earlier today. They've been talking about that quite a bit. The caller, this will be our last comment. The caller at 5771, did you have a final comment before we conclude?
Yes, I was calling in regards to the topic Emmy brought up about interracial relationships.
We finished that topic. See there. That's why I said we do not do Area 8 on the compensatory call-in. We're done with Area 8. Sounds like this was going to be something. Not a problem. Not apology. But that's why we don't do Area 8 on the compensatory call-in, because it will dominate the whole discussion. With that, we will be here. You just hit the Black Talk Radio Network page, Facebook page. Always will be updated for the program. We'll certainly be here on Thursday for Workplace Racism, but I think we'll be here before that, just trying to make sure we get our dates together. The black male who wrote the book, The Pogrom, on the 100-year anniversary of the East St. Louis, what they call race riots. He should be with us. I'm just trying to get the date down. Drop an email if you have questions, gripes. If you cannot find something in the archives or just any other information you might need, untiljustice@gmail.com, untiljustice@gmail.com. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. I was going to say, I think for next week, unless folks are totally opposed, if listeners want to pick the sound clips for the compensatory call-in, that would be great. We'll see, if there's a difference in the segments that get picked. But if folks are down, you can just drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. You could send them to Facebook as well. But listeners, feel free. Select audio clips, news clips for next week's compensatory call-in. That would be great. We're looking forward to seeing what segments folks find. With that, we'll wrap things up. I know it's summertime. It's great. It was a lovely day here in Seattle. Get out and enjoy the weather. Get your sunshine. I would just encourage folks to remain codified. Racists, they do not cease activities just because the weather is nice. You do not know when you might bump into a race soldier, badge or no. You want to make sure that you're functioning at maximum capacity so that you can make phenomenal decisions to keep yourself safe, anybody you might be responsible for. There's a lot of evidence that non-white people being under the influence can be greatly hampered when dealing with race soldiers, again, badge or no. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Context of White Supremacy signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.